Ahead on Boston Public Radio, last week we asked you about your faith in compromise after our talk with Stacey Abrams. Well, today, as we wait and wait with our daily Manchinima update and the heavily scaled back social infrastructure package allegedly heading to completion, we'll open the lines and ask you, is all this not depressing you? We'll also check in with CNN's John King at the end of the show.
Then it's Tuesday, which means we've got NBC Sports Boston's Tony Kuznarek calling in on that much-needed win for the Patriots on Sunday and anti-vax protesters storming New York's Barclays Center in support of the benched, vaccine-refusing Kyrie Irving. Then in the noon hour, Governor Charlie Baker will join us. All that ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So a bunch of you have contacted us saying we're going to talk about the mayor's race today since the final debate was last night. And the answer is we're going to have both of the candidates separately, but both of the candidates with us tomorrow. So we thought we'd hold off till we talk to Asabi George and Wu directly. And then later this week, we're going to take your calls on this incredible race that's coming to a head next Tuesday.
Had some big moments, some fiery moments
there
last
were.
Night.
They did a nice job. In any case, in the interim, as you know, President Joe Biden is headed to Europe later this week, hoping that Democrats come to an agreement on the spending bill that represents much of his agenda before he takes off. But regardless of the win, what results will ultimately be a shrunken version of what Biden initially intended. Democrat holdouts like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema push for a smaller price tag for some proposals like free public college, and some of the climate change provisions to be cut out entirely. So we want to check in with you. How are you feeling as this bill hopefully gets closer to yes? Are you celebrating the victories, even if it's a, for example, a limited extension of the child tax credit? It's an extension nevertheless. Or are you like Marjorie, downright despondent? The number is 877-301-8970. Now, before you weigh in and explain that, I want to say something. Last week while you were away, Jared and I took calls, fabulous calls, by the way, on how people felt about compromise, both in Congress and in their own personal lives. I thought it was great. This is not about...
Was there a conclusion?
This is not, no. It was just a lot of great insight. This is not about the compromise part of it. It's sort of like, and tell me if I'm phrasing your despondency properly, it's when you wake up every morning. Remember we used to wake up and we had to read Trump's tweets every morning?
That's right.
You wake up now and the first face you see on television is Joe Manchin.
That's right.
And
Joe
I have
Manchin.
To say, I didn't vote for him.
I love him personally.
I didn't even vote against him. He's in West Virginia. I am so sick of the Manchin Cinema daily, hourly update. Yeah. I can't see straight. So is that why you're despondent?
I'm despondent, Jim. I'm trying to keep my sense of humor about it.
Oh, good.
I think we're going right down the tubes.
Excellent.
We're going right down the tubes. You know, there was this great Nate Cohn piece in the Washington Post talking about polls seem to depict a pessimistic and even hopeless electorate.
Oh, great.
I may be in the latter category, but I'm trying to keep hope alive and thinking that, you know, it's just all about money. We're not going to do anything. We're not going to do anything significant about stuff people need, like help with their dental care when they're
old. Can you
old.
Stay on that for a second? Joe Manchin yesterday said it's not fiscally responsible to do that. And so the fact that he wasn't asked, and I'm not criticizing the reporters. They were pretty good with him. The response, well, okay, it's not fiscally responsible, according to you, for the United States government, but it's fiscally responsible for a senior on Medicare who can't afford to have his or her teeth taken care of.
That's, right.
That's fiscal. You know what this is all about, by the way? The reason it is not in the bill, because all the companies that sell the supplemental Medicare policies for dental, vision, and whatever, which most seniors can't afford, they're lobbying against it because it would take away their business.
That's
it has nothing
it's
to do with helping real people.
Exactly. Why can't we negotiate drug prices
you
for
are
older
so
people?
Right.
Why? Because
so
the pharmaceutical
right.
companies are lobbying heavily and taking people off on these trips where they all drink wine and lie on the beach and
I'd
run around in bikinis and stuff like that.
Or less
I mean,
even
we're
in
just
some
going
cases.
Down the tubes. I'm glad that I was born, you know, when we still had some hope that things were going to improve.
Really?
When you thought, I remember there was a time, Jim, call me Pollyanna and naive, but there was a time when I said to myself, kind of like what Winston Churchill said back during World War II, that, you know, the Americans, they'll hem and they'll haw and they'll complain and they'll whine. But ultimately, I'm paraphrasing rather grandly here.
Yeah.
They'll do the right thing. You know what I know about the Americans now?
No.
We're going to do the wrong thing. And you know what else?
What?
I've had it with Joe Biden, too. Mm. I mean...
Because you think he should just be tough with
Sinema
and Manchin.
I think he should haul in these two people and find a way to screw them at every corner. But he seems not to because, you know, he's operating like
Senate?
It's still 1975 instead of 2021. And you know what?
Mm.
I've had it with this parliamentarian, too. Why?
Who is this parliamentarian? Who no one voted for.
Yeah. Do you know who the parliamentarian is?
Yes, I know him or her very well.
Exactly. I mean, this is the person that's holding up all these different provisions.
Well, immigration in particular.
Exactly.
We're going to talk to Ali Noorani.
Get rid of the parliamentarian. Get him out of there.
I'll give
this to the Republicans. You know the Republicans
do? Wow, you are on fire.
They play hardball. And we're worrying about the Queensbury rules as parliamentarian. I mean, really.
Okay, so what we're going to do today, in addition to taking your calls at 877-301-8970, you as despondent as Marjorie appears to be, what we'll do is we'll intersperse between despondent or non-despondent calls. We will try to give you an update on, one, what Joe Manchin's position mm-hmm. is on everything every couple of minutes.
Yep.
And, two, try to give you an update on what country in Europe Kyrsten Sinema is visiting. To raise funds. Well, no, she's back. That's not
and
really
let me
fair.
Just say one last thing.
Wow.
Okay. Whenever many years ago when Trump came in, we gave this $2 trillion tax break over 10 years.
That was 2016.
That was 2016.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
To people that were millionaires and billionaires.
Correct.
And we gave a big
wealthier
cut
people,
in corporate tax rate. And we probably did need a cut in the corporate tax rate. Not quite as far as we mm-hmm. went with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So now we can't even get $2 trillion over 10 years. I mean, this is going to be less than $2
trillion. In spending on real people.
Yeah, because Joe Manchin thinks that's too expensive. And as we all know, he runs the country. He thinks that's too expensive. So we can't even get that for child care, for schools,
no.
for early childcare, for
no,
teeth, for teeth. Think about that. Mm. You know what? I'm going to need some dental work when I'm in my 80s, Jim.
Yeah.
And I want some help with my dental
work. We are
work.
A pro-tooth show.
We are
here.
A pro-tooth show.
877.
You never know when, you know, a tooth could fall out, Jim.
It's
what are you
true.
Supposed to do?
877-301-8970. You okay?
Yes,
can we take
I'm,
the calls
I'm,
or
I'm,
no?
I'm fine. Well, listen.
By the Cambridge, way, I can't believe you didn't even mention
what?
The most important climate
most
provision
important?
Came out
oh,
of this bill
yeah.
because of Joe Manchin,
yeah,
by the way.
That's right. Okay. You know what's happening today? We're going to have we have torrential rains in California. We have mudslides and fires.
It's only 12 inches of rain in California.
It's like the whole country is – it's that's the other mm-hmm. thing you have to decide.
Mm-hmm.
And you better decide it soon. Do you want to go by fire or do you want to go by water? Because that's where we're going to be. And it could be a matter of months at the rate we're going. Melissa from Cambridge, thank you for calling.
Hey, Melissa.
Good morning.
Hey there.
I'm laughing because I could just as much talk about teeth as I'm going to talk about climate.
Exactly.
In this case, I want to point to a story actually in the Boston Globe this morning in which it notes that Massachusetts has vastly underestimated its emissions from natural gas.
Oh, yeah. That was
now,
a great story.
You know, we've been fighting this for a long, long time up here in terms of the Weymouth situation, the pipelines, et cetera. But this study actually finds that the methane, and I want to focus on methane for a minute, because the man whose name we will not mention from West Virginia mm-hmm. has not only decided that he is going to get rid of the clean energy portion, and Biden's already given him that, but now he's going after the methane rules
right.
as well. He wants more. So here in Massachusetts, we found out that our leak rate is 6 times higher than we estimated, 6 times higher. You know, this story is on the Yale site today. It's in the Washington Post. It's in the Boston Globe. We are moving in totally the wrong direction on this. And methane is a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2 emissions. It's more powerful.
Well, you know what else was upsetting about that story, Melissa? That it was saying they think maybe the bulk of this now is coming from our homes, from the furnaces.
Well, it is, because we've done a fairly good job in fixing the leaks only because advocates have pushed to make it essential and make it, you know, the law that the utility companies have to fix the big leaks.
Right.
So now what they've looked at is they're looking at the inside of buildings. And we know this. this is where methane is happening because we use natural gas for our stoves, our boilers, our water heaters, et cetera. And what it's doing is it's leaking into the places that we live.
Well, you know,
and it's causing the asthma rates, et cetera. So,
Melissa, that was a great call. And we should add to that, too, that we just learned a couple of weeks ago, actually, that the Department of Public Utilities thought it would be a good idea for the gas companies to rewrite the regulations about how we get rid of natural gas. I thought that was a clever idea, the fox guarding the chicken coop kind of philosophy. How do you think that's going to work out?
I don't know. But, you know, in light of what Melissa said,
we're going to ask the governor about this, by the way, later on.
The one fact that she left out about Manchin is his birth name was Joe Methane, and his family. We haven't reported that. It's an exclusive here on Boston Public Radio. But his family, when he went to kindergarten, thought they should change it to Manchin because obviously it was a dead giveaway. Melissa, thanks for a terrific call.
Why is Joe Manchin even getting to vote? I mean,
you got to stop. By the way, they're entitled to take money legally from anybody they want. Everybody's got a bias. Some are pro-people bias.
Again,
some are pro-fossil fuel industry bias.
If you are making $500,000 a year from the coal industry and your son took over the business that you used to run, and you are your fortune is tied up in keeping coal running, and really, how many people really want to work in a coal mine?
Not many.
There's a conflict of interest there, Jim. There's a conflict of interest.
Well, it's public, it's disclosed, and it's legal. I mean, you know, you may not like it, but it's legal.
Well, so is insider trading, basically.
Insider trading, thanks to Scott Brown, actually, Senator Scott Brown, was at least limited after that came
to
light.
But, I mean, I don't want to get off on that whole other subject.
It does seem
that there is a lot of people are loading up and getting rid of stock. We've seen this continuing even post Scott Brown, knowing what's going on with legislation. Is that not continuing?
So what you're basically saying is you think some of these elected officials are affected by the donations they receive from large businesses. Is that what you're saying?
I think that everything basically has come down to money. And it's kind of a problem. I don't mean to be pessimistic about it.
No, I wouldn't want you to.
Because I'm trying to.
Your question earlier: do you want to die by water or fire? I think was a upbeat, at least giving people the freedom to choose, which I think is very healthy.
I'd go with water myself.
You would?
Yes,
yeah.
I would.
Okay,
Sophia
great.
From Cambridge, thank you for
Hi,
calling.
Hi, Sophia. What's up?
Hey, everyone. Good morning.
Hi.
Emotion is energy in motion. So what I always like to do is I don't get mad. I simply keep this long list of states that I boycott.
Oh, great.
I find the products and services that they offer, and I let them know that I'm not going to travel to their state. I'm not going to go to conferences at their state. I'm not going to buy anything from their state. I let their governors know. I let their representatives know. And if everybody would follow suit, the pressure that would come to bear on Disney in Florida would pour pressure back up to the legislatures to let them know that you are impacting our bottom line. People, you know, we always talk about this. We always talk about the fact we hate Amazon, but we buy from them. In this case, I really, really mean what I say. I don't go to Arizona. I'm not going to go to Florida. I'm not going to go to Michigan. I'm not going to go to any of these places. I won't visit friends who live there. They know that. I'm not going to put dollars in their pockets.
Wow.
Well, that is very impressive. Why did you single out Disney, though, Sophia?
Powerful
because
company.
It's a very, very powerful company. It's so visible, and it's smack in the middle of a state that has a lot of sway and makes ridiculous decisions, especially as it pertains to the health of our children. And so I don't have any children, but I've been a mask wearer, and I will be a mask wearer forever until every child is vaccinated because I have friends who have children. But more importantly, you know, if somebody in Atlanta were to come out, Coca-Cola were to come out, if Disney were to come out, if all of these very large corporations in those states were to come out and take a stand, and of course, I know they don't want to because, of course, favors go both ways. But at the end of the day, we the people have to take back our government. We are our government. And so we need to make very conscious choices. I also make those same kinds of choices when I'm traveling to Europe. I won't go to certain countries where, you know, human rights are just a travesty. I mean, I know a lot of people would say that about the U.S., but
Sophia, do you worry? I don't think you do because you sound like a person of principle. When the only state you can visit is Vermont in a couple of years, do you worry that you're going to have a limited set of options, or do you not care?
No, because I think all the cool, principled people were going to end up with me there.
It's I think
like
you're
when someone tells me to go to
you
hell,
are great.
Like, hey, I know, all seriousness. I'll join you.
You are great. I'm serious.
You're great. You're a better person than I am, Sophia, that's for sure.
That is great, by the way. That's sort of like a list of my bands. The only thing is I don't honor any of the list. She does. She lives by her principles, which is really... You feeling better or not?
No, like I said, I'm trying to keep my sense of humor about this, Jim, because you can either laugh or cry, and I figure you may as well laugh. We're talking about the Democrats' spending bill. More important, we're talking about your mood at the particular moment. Are you pessimistic and even hopeless about the prospects of getting any changes around here? If you somebody that thinks we need some changes, and I'm one of them, that conversation continues on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brother. She's Marjorie again. And Marjorie is despondent about the state of affairs in Washington. I think that's a bit of an understatement. You know what I can add to your list of your despondency list?
What?
Yesterday, after the White House leaked that Manchin had agreed to the $1.75 trillion figure, did you see that Manchin did a press availability? And simply to stick it to Biden, as he's walking away from the reporters, he turns around and says, I'm still at $1.5 trillion, trying to create a shrinking presidency.
Right.
Why did he have to do that, by the way? He stated what his position was on the issues.
Because,
why doesn't he just walk away?
Because he's getting away with it. He's getting away. What is President Biden doing about this?
I have no idea.
I mean, they're
no
having
idea.
Conversations. That's really swell. I want a little, you know, Lyndon Johnson, a little Abraham Lincoln, a little hardball. You know, I think you got to drag him in and...
beat the crap out of him? Is that what's... Where are you going with this? What is he supposed to do?
Biden's a fit man to pay a price. And you know what else? $60,000 may get you somewhere in West Virginia, which is one of the poorest states in the United States of America. But it's not going to get you anywhere in most of the blue states, the states that produce all the income from the United States.
You mean you're talking about the cap that he wants to impose on the child tax credit?
Is it child care?
Okay.
It's child care. I mean, if you have to pay $1,000 or $1,500 a month for child care and you make $60,000 a year between you and your husband, you're not going to get very far.
Well, in all fairness, obviously you haven't read everything. What you can do in West Virginia is put the kids in the mines. And so just pick them up. Leave them at 9, pick them up at 5.
Remember, you always wanted to have the children wear a little miner's hat so
they
could get out there in the dark and see the way to
school. We're doing that later this week. Daylight saving time is happening.
Here's
and
an
it is
opportunity.
Gross.
You'll finally be
ending.
Able to see children in little miner's hats.
Exactly. In West Virginia. Let's go to, I think it's Cape Medic, in Maine, but Eric, wherever, is calling from that place. Hi, Eric. Welcome.
Hi there. Hey, hi, Marguerite. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Hey, what's up, Eric?
Good. Hey, so I've got so much to say.
I'm sure.
The problem is not the money. The problem is the loyalty to their parties. If somebody bombs somewhere tomorrow, I'm sure we'd find $3 trillion to go piss away in a foreign country, right? Killing people and blowing things up. No problem, no questions asked. What we need in this area is David Brudnoy and Gene Burns. As much as I love you two.
Two late wonderful talk show hosts, by the way.
Yeah, they were great.
Yes, but the phrase that Gene Burns used to use is, we need a president with some testicular fortitude to go in to Manchin and say, you are from one of the states that takes most of the federal funds for your citizens. We're going to hold that back until you come to our side of the aisle.
Well, Eric, the only place I disagree with you, knowing both those men, they both would oppose almost every single dollar of spending in this Biden bill. Because they're both they're wonderful people and really, really small government people. So while the tactics you describe that Gene Burns might prescribe are accurate, I think where they'd settle in terms of what government should do for the American people, you're a little off kilter. But Eric, thank you kindly for bringing back some fond memories. 877-301-8970. You were a regular on Dave Rudnoy's show on VZ.
We used to do a little debate on WBC.
The two of you did on TV. I forgot about that.
We were awful, I must admit.
You thought so?
Yeah, it was terrible.
Do you believe who's on the phone, by the way?
Oh, my God. It's Sean from Dedham. Sean, you've called me in my hour of need.
Hey, Sean.
I'm ready for some advice.
I Jimmy, what's going on?
Yeah,
Marjorie, seriously,
Jim.
I turn the radio on, right?
Yeah.
I'm listening to Jim from Nessen, and I'm like, oh, geez. You
know, NECN, and I haven't worked there in 10 years, but that's okay. Sean,
and, go ahead. All right, I'm talking to Marjorie.
Sorry.
Marjorie,
excuse me. Yes.
I wanted to drive into a bridge abutment. I mean, you got me. Seriously, Debbie Downer. I mean,
I'm sorry.
The leaves are changing. We have rainwater. We need rain. You know,
yeah.
Biden's clear of mind. Well, maybe not that. But, you know, things are great. I mean, by the way, Sophia, life of the party. Huh? You want to bring that girl to a party? Holy moly. Jimmy, she's something, huh? Wow.
Wow.
Does she like anything? What does she like, that girl? She told everything she hates.
She likes Vermont, actually.
Sean, tell me what I should be excited about.
Footbridge. Let's talk about a footbridge in Everett, Jimmy. Like that is,
footbridge.
I heard about this. The footbridge in Everett, I mean, $50 million. Are you kidding me? What is going on here?
Well, but the governor said even if there's not money from the feds, he's going to find the money somewhere so we can all get to the casino more easily by walking or biking.
That's what we really need.
Yep.
The casino that I didn't want, I don't want gambling at all. And oh, forget about it.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. But yes, Marjorie, please speak. Yes,
I just wanted to know, Sean, if you could give me a little nugget here that I should
I
could hold on to get me through the rest of the day. What do you think?
Well, the last time I saw you on TV, you looked absolutely stunning.
That's all I needed.
So can you hold on to it?
I'll hold on to that, Sean.
Jimmy,
thank you.
Jimmy, I really can't say. Jimmy, you look like John Kerry a little bit. You know, if you don't mind me saying, you're looking a little rough, Dick.
Sean, we've missed you, sort of. Thank you for your fine call,
thank
as always.
Thank you very much. Thank you very
877-301-8970 is our phone number.
You know, my email's not connected if people wanted to.
Oh,
I'm not reading it. No, I'm working on it, though. Irene from Ipswich. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Irene.
Hi. I guess I'm a three-and-a-half time caller. Last time I didn't get through, you ran out of time.
Oh, sorry. That's sad. Sorry. Hi.
Yeah. I'm going back to what you opened up on about, you know, sort of the plight of senior citizens.
Yeah.
I recently became, you know, I'm 67 years old, and I take care of my 95-year-old mother.
Oh,
I'm
good
for
you.
I'm a full-time caregiver. She lives in my home since she broke a hip and had to have a hip and an elbow replaced during COVID. But I'm just appalled at this whole Social Security situation. First of all, women have been getting paid less than men for our professional jobs, for most jobs. We haven't had all the doors open to us where we could make a lot of money and then achieve maximum Social Security. So why is a woman expected to live on a Social Security check of $1,400 a month where most men are getting $2,800 a month? It just doesn't seem fair to me.
I thought it was about how much
money.
Isn't Social Security about how much you worked
and how much you earned? I didn't think it was gender based.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I didn't.
But since
Irene,
women make less than men for the same, go ahead, Irene.
It is kind of gender based, only because you know women for years, like my mother,
make less.
They stayed at home with the kids.
Yeah,
they still contributed to the country. By raising the
That's
kids,
a very good
by
point.
Doing whatever they did in the community for free, whatever they do. So
sure.
I just don't feel there should be such a wide discrepancy between what women get for Social Security and what men get for Social Security.
Well, Irene, can I tell you why it's good you called? Is it gives Marjorie something else to be aggravated about during the show. Irene, we're glad you got through, and thank you much for the call. Irene's point is great. Her point, I think, is not that there's a built-in statutory discrepancy between what men and women get, but because of how women were treated in the workplace and how their work, you know, their less pay for the same work, staying home, taking care of the kids,
no,
or
that
other
is an
things.
Excellent point.
Obviously, their employment history and their earnings are such that they do take home less from Social Security. So it was an excellent point.
Sharon just sent an email.
What's that?
And she said, speaking of teeth, she said in her former life,
she
was involved for policy for MassHealth, and then the state paid to replace front teeth only, because really now that's all we really need is front teeth only. And now she does have a Medicare, but she finds she has no dental benefits at all. Even for the front teeth.
Can I tell you something? Of all the things that they are dropping, and by the way, it's not confirmed yet that that it's been dropped, but they believe it has been. The notion, we've said it 15 times here, that people who are on Medicare do not have their vision, their hearing, and most importantly, their teeth taken care of is unbelievable to me. And you know what's also interesting? A bunch of progressives criticized Biden's meeting at his house in Delaware. You know, he met, this is a very good point, I thought. He met with Schumer, obviously the Democratic leader, and Manchin at his house in Delaware over the weekend. You know who is not in the room there? Bernie Sanders, who is the chair of the Budget Committee, who is the lead progressive. Why were Manchin and Sanders both not there attempting to work out something rather than just once again giving an audience to President Manchin? I mean, it's just it is really. And, you know, the question for Manchin. So is he willing? Let's assume that the price tag is $2.5 trillion, which is way above what he'd do. Is he willing to give up all the things that would benefit all of the people of West Virginia because the price tag is, in other words, letting the perfect, in his estimation, stand in the way of the
good?
No,
he's a guy in his 70s who's got a lot of money who should retire. But he's not. He wants to hold on to his power. He wants to run again. And Trump was the
won by a landslide in West Virginia.
In West Virginia. So that's what he's doing. It's
I don't know if it's that or the fact that this is arguable. Did you know who Joe Manchin was a year and a half ago, 2 years ago? I mean, I'm sure you knew.
He
senator, former governor.
In college or something.
Well, I didn't even know that. But the bottom line is he's the highest profile non-president elected official in the United States of America. He's in the news nonstop every single day. A lot of people, Donald Trump being a good example, get off on that, you know?
Oh, no doubt about it. And that's one of the theories about Kirsten Sinema, is that she's enjoying all this attention,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I saw her going up an escalator somewhere with a constituent behind her asking her a climate change question. Maybe it was a reporter. It was hard to tell. And she just ignores them and keeps going and doesn't answer
actually,
any questions.
Actually, you're wrong. I'm sorry to correct you on error. The guy chasing on the escalator was Joe Biden. Was that? It was really unbecoming. He was running after her, begging her to...
I know. Don't you have? I mean, it seemed like Donald Trump could find a way to get what he wanted. I mean, can't Joe Biden try a little harder?
He couldn't move a guy by the name of John McCain, which, to McCain's everlasting credit, saved the Affordable Care Act with that thumbs down despite
right.
the pressure from
but
the president.
But the thing is about the Affordable Care Act, that was something that we needed once again, and you had all this Republican opposition, and everybody hated it until they found out. Remember all the town meetings screaming and yelling?
Yep.
And then they found socialized medicine, oh my God. And then when they found out what they were getting, because the Democrats, Obama, failed to sell the program, and once again we have Biden failing to sell this program. Somebody emailed last week and said, why didn't we run ads on the baseball playoffs? Not we.
Well, you said that to somebody.
Yeah,
Chuck Todd
or John
King.
People can see these ads. I mean, and that's the other thing, that these programs are very popular. People want help with child care. People want early childhood education.
I agree.
People want, obviously, to get dental care in their old age. People want these things. And we have this small minority of people that are running everything. But I'm going to try to keep my sense of humor.
No,
about
you
the
really
whole
have
thing.
Done it beautifully. This
and John
today.
Says, I really don't have to worry about anything because the way things are going, I won't have to, when things are bad and I can't get dental care in my old age, the water will be so deep in the cave that I can just walk right off my porch.
Exactly. And Sean from Dedham said, you look good on TV. So that's all that really matters.
That's right.
Carolyn and Melrose, you've been very patient. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to switch back to climate change.
Please.
There was just a report on NPR this morning of the Defense Department giving testimony to Congress, citing climate change as an existential threat. Now, and in fact, the Department of Defense has been giving testimony to Congress for more than 10 years talking about the adverse impact of climate change on our country's security. I cannot understand how Democrats and Republicans can't get behind resolving some climate change issues.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here, particularly the leader of the choir, Marjorie Egan, who is climate change obsessed, as we all should be. We're as incredulous about the lack of action as you are, Carolyn. But once again, the most important provision, according to most, that was in this original so-called reconciliation package, meaning the Democrats-only package, has been struck because one man, Joe Manchin, objected, and they need all 50 votes. I mean, that's the reality, the unfortunate reality of this nightmare. Carolyn, thank you for the call.
Joanna just sent me an email saying that there are hunger strikers from the Sunrise Movement I've been in front of the White House for 6 days. I don't know that either, Joanna, but I will look it up, and I assume you're right. Thank you for letting me know about that. They're the big climate change activist young group. Worked a lot for Markey when he won his re-election.
We have time for one more really quick one.
Bill from Chelmsford, thank you for calling.
Got a minute, Bill. Go.
Okay, real quick. I think there's one thing you got to look at behind all of this is money.
Right.
We got to get money out of politics, because the only way these people keep getting reelected is powerful money. And unless you can change that, everything, climate change all the way down the line. And that's the thing the Democrats should have focused on right in the beginning when they took over all the government, focused on changing those laws, get those changed, throw the filibuster out. Take money out of politics, and I'll bet you the average person has a lot more say, and then we'd be moving forward on all these proposals that Biden has. I really believe that.
I believe it, too. Bill, and thanks for the call.
And term limits, because if they weren't always in there trying to, you know—
Well, it can't be. They have to vote on term limits to change the Constitution themselves.
Do you think they
are they
going to
vote to term limit themselves?
Do you think they're going to vote on getting money out of politics?
I'd say the odds are small, but maybe a little better than—
Although you do feel sorry for some of these people. What do they spend, like, 15, you know, constantly on the phone, dialing for dollars, asking for money all day long?
It's a major time commitment, supposedly. Particularly members of the House have to run every 2 years, as opposed to a senator who at least gets six. And while he or she needs more money to run, they at least have 6 years to raise it. Every member of the House starts raising the second they're elected for their reelection. It's a mess.
Okay,
so you feeling better?
No, I'm not. I think it's big trouble, Jim. Big trouble.
Okay.
But I'm trying to keep a good sense of humor on the entire
really
subject.
No, you really have. Totally. They really incredibly uplifting.
Coming up, NBC Sports Authority, Trini Kuznarek joins us. We're going to talk about anti-vaxxers protesting in favor of Kyrie Irving of the Brooklyn Nets. He's unvaccinated, of course. And the fate of Tom Brady's 600th touchdown football. Could it be worth $500,000? All that is next with Trini Kuznarek of Sports Authority. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and the despondent Marjorie Egan. Joining us now to go over a much-needed win for the Patriots. Actually, and much more important, the former Patriot quarterback and what he's doing. And more from the world of sports is Trini Kuznarek. Trini is an anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston. Also a BPR contributor. Welcome, Trini. Good to talk to you.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Did you see my Zoom message to you?
No.
I'm going to Minnesota to cover curling on Thursday.
You are?
Oh,
excited.
My God.
By the way, for
my
those
God.
Who don't know, she covered curling in the Olympics when the U.S. won the gold not too long ago. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got two big events coming up, Jim, because as you know, the Beijing Olympics are headed our way in just over 100 days. So we have mixed doubles curling Olympic trials coming up this weekend, though... It doesn't get you. It's kind of a convoluted thing. We don't need to get into it now. But the team who wins this weekend doesn't necessarily get to go to Beijing. It's more complicated than that.
Mm.
And then we've got team women and men's team trials in Omaha, Nebraska in November. But up first, I'm sure you guys are jealous. And you've always wanted to travel here. Eveleth, Minnesota, which is an hour north of Duluth. Yeah.
You know, wait a second. Do you say the Summer Olympics are in less than 100 days? Is that what you said?
Well, the Winter Olympics.
Winter Olympics. I'm sorry. The Winter
Olympics. A little over 100 days.
Wow. That is incredible.
I know. It's insane, right?
So, Trini Kuznarek, I saw pictures of thousands of anti-vaxxers blocking the Brooklyn Bridge. A lot of cops and firefighters in New York City upset about de Blasio, the mayor's mandates about getting vaccinated. I didn't know until this morning about these anti-vax protesters storming the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, where the Brooklyn Nets play basketball, and in support of Kyrie Irving. So,
in support of Kyrie, because the Nets have made the decision. This is a team decision, by the way, not a state of New York or a city of New York decision. But the team has decided that if you can't play all the games, you cannot play or practice with us at all. So, Kyrie, either you can get vaccinated like the rest of your teammates and be a good teammate, or you can sit at home and watch basketball. And he is choosing to sit at home and watch basketball. But, you know, I guess it's not a huge surprise that there are people who side with Kyrie and they took to the Barclays Center the other day to show their support of him. But the thing where it starts to get like a little scary is, right, like, so they had put barricades up and they allowed them to protest peacefully, but then they stormed these barricades. Like, listen, it was obviously nothing like what we ever saw in Washington, D.C., but, you know, it does raise the question that, is this going to keep happening where the security guards and the police officers who are taxed with keeping these areas safe, you know, is this going to happen more and more if as these regulations are put into place? I hope not. And I would hope that Kyrie Irving would say, while I appreciate your support, let's keep everything peaceful. Because I think that someone like him, his word carries, for these people, carries a lot of weight.
By the way, I've asked this before and I forgot the answer. Is he getting paid or is he not getting paid?
He does not get paid.
Zero for the whole season. And he makes almost $40 million a year, doesn't he?
Yes, he is. Like, I think it was if the Nets would have allowed him to play away games, I think the loss of money would have been like 17 or 18 million or something. Yeah. But yeah, he's not getting paid at all. You don't play, and it's optional. It's not like, you know, he could get vaccinated and have a job and play basketball. He is choosing not to, and so the Nets don't have to pay him.
And what's his reason?
Well, he says it's not political, Marjorie. He just feels like you should be able to make your own decisions for your own body and your own self, and that it's more complicated than that. He's just trying to make a statement.
Okay.
Listen, I mean, hey, you know what? You want to make a statement? Go ahead. But as we've said a million times on this show, everyone knows I agree wholeheartedly with the two of you. You do have a freedom of choice. And then you also have the, you know, the consequences that go with that freedom of choice. And the consequences, you don't get to play basketball for the Brooklyn Nets and you don't get paid.
Yeah, but the flip, I agree with all that, particularly because you agree with us. But there's a second factor. It's not just you pay, there are consequences. He's screwing his coworkers.
Yeah, screwing his teammates.
I mean, it's sort of, I'm thinking what you were talking a minute ago. If you decided, Marjorie, I'm serious about this. It's not a punchline at the end. You decided not to get vaccinated and you couldn't come in the building because the rule is here, you got to get vaccinated. Mm-hmm. Or maybe even worse, you couldn't even do the thing from home. I think you'd argue, we love Jared Bowen, for example. It would probably do some damage to the show. So you're sort of screwing me by your, I mean, you're not infecting me, but by your decision, which is exactly what Irving is doing. A team that many thought could win the championship loses one of its three great players. I mean, it really is, I would argue,
it's
really selfish. I mean,
it's selfish.
In any case, we're talking to Trenny Kuznarek. You know, Trenny, I have to say, I said it in passing when I was introducing you. I haven't seen the stats, and maybe you guys out at NBC Sports Boston or the Globe or someplace. I would argue the biggest sports story still in Boston is anything that Tom Brady does. Maybe for a minute it was the Red Sox. It is unbelievable. So he plays a game the other day. He throws his 600th TD pass, which is an all-time record. You can tell us what happened with that. And while he's at it, he's not only throwing his 600th TD pass, which is the most any quarterback has ever done in the pros, and that's not to mention the ones he did in the playoff, with a half minute left in the game, he walks over a kid and does an incredibly generous act. So share both those stories with us, if you would.
So should we do the heartwarming story?
Do the heartwarming, because it's great. No, I love that. Tell
the
story.
With that? Okay, yeah. So this is actually a really great story. There was a young boy, a nine-year-old boy named Noah, who actually last year I was diagnosed. He was having headaches. He was diagnosed with a small brain tumor, which was cancerous. He went through surgery, chemo, radiation. Mm-hmm. And at some point, someone had reached out and the story had gotten to Tom Brady about how this kid was like, this one kid in Utah was this big Tom Brady fan. So last year when he was going through all of this, the mom tells a story about how they just gotten back from another treatment at the hospital and they're having a conversation in the car about mental perseverance and how this is difficult, but you're going to get through it. And it's like, we just have to push through the hard stuff and then the good stuff will come later. And she gets this notification on her phone that Tom Brady has videotaped a message for Noah. So it was just a short little thing that he put on Instagram for him. And so but it changed. I mean, this is how a small kind gesture from someone who is looked up to like Tom Brady could like change this kid's life.
I
like
totally agree.
That gave him all the motivation. Like, wow, Tom Brady thinks enough of me. I'm going to keep fighting this really hard battle. And so the kid was at the game on Sunday, and he had a sign that said, "I beat cancer because of Tom Brady."
Oh, wow.
And Brady went up afterwards. I'm getting told this story again. He went up and he talked to the kid and he gave him, they have like a cancer hat this month. Yeah. It's breast cancer awareness, but I think also just cancer awareness in general. And he gave him, you know, the hat from the Buccaneers and talked to him for a little bit. And what just a cool, I mean, and listen, he didn't like, it's not like Brady advertised it. It was just a small, genuine gesture, you know, to for this kid. It's just, it's really, as much as like, sometimes I'm like, I cringe at some of the things Tom Brady does. He really does a lot. Not all star athletes do. And he does a lot often quietly for people who look up to him and who need a little motivation and a little kindness.
Okay. So same game, he throws a 600th touchdown pass to Mike, what's his name? Goodwin?
Mike Evans.
Sorry, it's the other one's going.
No, it's Chris Godwin. Yeah,
right.
Chris Godwin.
Evans does what with the ball, which leads to a bit of a conundrum. What happens?
So Evans hands it to a guy in the stands who's wearing a Mike Evans jersey. So he's like, "Oh, look at this guy. He likes me. I caught the touchdown pass. I'm going to give him the football." And then I don't know if you guys have seen the video, but they have the video of Mike Evans sitting on the sideline when he realizes, like, "Oh, crap. I should not have given that guy that football." So obviously the Buccaneers do what teams do. And they went to this guy in the stands and said, "Hey, listen, his name is Byron. You know, listen, we know this, you really want this football and it's a big collector's item, but it's really important." Like, you know, Brady admitted, he said, "A lot of times, you know, personal numbers don't mean a lot, but this one was a big deal for me. I really want this one." So he gives the ball up, but then he finds out afterwards the ball is worth over $500,000. So he's not ever going to get the $500,000, although my fancy fiance tells me that he learned in a tax law class that actually it's not a good thing to have that football, because if it's worth $500,000 and it's in your possession, you will owe taxes on that $500,000 football.
Oh,
hey, can you tell wait, can you tell your fiance something? Sell the damn football and then you pay the taxes and you have $350,000 left over.
But I think people simply think like, "Oh my God, you would have had 500 grand. Like, it's more complicated than that. But at any rate, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, you know, of course gave him like season passes for the rest of this year, next year, $1,000 to spend in, you know, an autograph stuff. And then Brady threw in one Bitcoin because he owns Bitcoin. So he gave him one of his own Bitcoin, which is worth $63,000 as of the writing of the article I read.
Guy
so he
still
didn't
got
quite
screwed.
Get the 500 that he did sort of still get screwed. But I do wonder, like, what, you know, I will say this. He might have gotten screwed, Jim, but you know what? There are too many people in this world who are greedy and think about themselves. And everyone's calling this guy an idiot and saying what a moron he is. But I actually think, like, that's a big deal for Tom Brady. And you didn't have to give it up. You could have been a jerk. You could have held the whole thing hostage. But instead you said, "Yeah, sure, here, I'll take some signed stuff and hang out." Like, I think that says a whole lot about this Byron guy, who he could have been a jerk about it. And instead he said, "You earned this. I'll give it back and take whatever you give to me."
Well, except the only thing, I agree with all that. It's a good thing to do. But when Brady gave him the Bitcoin, he should have said, "I'll take two." I mean, that's what I would have did. You know, before we leave Brady, there's a
they should have thrown in a smug mug.
Well, a smug mug, absolutely.
There's none left, unfortunately. None left. So in any case,
I know, I've been trying to get one for years.
Well, keep asking. So Brady last night is on with the, you know, the Mannings. I assume most people know that Peyton Manning, one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time, and Eli Manning, his brother, not so great, but great enough to beat Tom Brady 2 out of 2 in the Super Bowl.
Right.
Have this thing called the Manning Cast on ESPN2, I think it is, during Monday Night Football. Here's Brady having a little fun with the Mannings, and the response, which I think is pretty clever, even though it's planned, is from Eli, the guy who conquered Brady not once, but twice in the Super Bowl playing for the New York Giants. Here it is.
"The games we played against each other, although I enjoyed them much, much more, the ones I played against Peyton and Eli, you know, You guys just, we had so many great battles. So I
enjoyed all
being
our
a
games,
part of them.
Tom. I really enjoyed them all."
That's a pretty clever line there from Eli Manning, whether it was planned or not. We're talking to Trini.
I'll be honest, Jim. I don't know if it was a planned line.
Well,
right?
Maybe it was.
You probably are just having casual, you're just having conversation, and he says, "You know, I clearly enjoyed playing Peyton because I beat Peyton and I couldn't, you know, you know, I didn't enjoy it against you. And I said, oh, I really did enjoy mine against you. That's I'm going to give line. Eli credit that he just thought of that off the top of his head.
Yeah. And by the way, after that line, I don't know if you know, Eli Manning gave Brady a Bitcoin. That was the... And then he just handed it to Byron Kennedy. Yeah,
and a signed jersey.
Yeah.
One last thing about this. I think this. Have we settled the Belichick versus Brady? Who is the superior thing yet? I mean, given Brady's last year and then so far this year. I mean, Belichick to me looks just foolish.
Patriots crushed the Jets.
They did.
Though,
they did really well. And this Mac Jones is a young man. He looks very extremely promising, and he's a very tough guy and all that sort of thing. But obviously, Tom Brady can still play football, and that's why Belichick to me looks silly.
I think that you could unequivocally say that Bill Belichick made a mistake in thinking and assuming that Tom Brady was finished and they shouldn't keep him around, and not maybe having the foresight to say, well, even if it puts our franchise back a little bit, let's put some weapons around him, keep him around. But I don't know if that necessarily settles the who is better, or, you know, chicken or the egg, Brady or Belichick, because it's going to take Brady went into a ready-made situation for him in Tampa. Belichick has to rebuild everything. So let's see. I can't make that distinction until we see if Belichick is able to rebuild behind Mac Jones and take the Patriots to prominence again. Beating the Jets, as lovely as it was, Marjorie, prominence.
So, we're talking with Trini Kuznarek from NBC Sports. So, Trini, tell us what's going on in our soccer team. We don't talk much about the New England Revolution.
Tell us what's going on. How many years have you and I talked about, Marjorie? Are the Revs ever going to win the supporter sheath or not? And finally,
you mean the supporter shield?
Oh, shield! Oops.
That's right. We've talked about it so many times. And got the name wrong every single solitary time because we have never talked about it.
Okay, whatever it is, what the hell is it?
Well, in fairness, Jim, we've never talked about it before because the Revs have never won it before. They've never had the best record in Major League Soccer, and they have never had the number one seed going into the postseason. Okay. I love, by the way, that your producer, Zoe, I had no idea she was such a huge Revs fan. Like, she's like, I think
she is.
The story is.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, I thought she may have been a soccer player too.
I can't remember. But
about it. I think she's like a really big soccer fan. Mm. So it's amazing. But they're honestly arguably the best team in town right now. They have a chance to win a title in the ML and Major League Soccer. And so what I didn't even know until I read this story is that by virtue of having the number one overall seed in MLS playoffs, you don't play any of the ancillary games. You get right into the semifinals.
Yeah.
So you start in the semifinals, and they could host a MLS Cup final at Gillette Stadium on December 11th.
Well, that's pretty good.
So look out for that. I mean, Bruce Arena has really done a tremendous job. I mean, he's the head coach, or the, I guess his manager is what they call it in soccer, similar to baseball. But he really has done a phenomenal job just bringing in really great top tier players. I mean, their goalie and Matt Turner is turned into the U.S. men's national team, like a stopper. I mean, listen, I'm not a huge soccer person, but my show producer loves the Revs. And you know what? They deserve the due that they're getting. They deserve more attention. They are a really good team. You know, like winners, Boston. You got one just down the road in Gillette. It's just not the one that plays on Sunday.
Well, you know, I went to a Revolutions game a few years ago. Yes, I did.
And they're
Your younger daughter is a big time soccer player.
She loves
too.
Soccer. The whole team, I think,
remembers
the team. She was a good soccer player. Yes, she was. She still plays soccer. Actually, as a young adult, they have big fields over there by the hospitals on Longwood Avenue. Anyway, but the thing is, it's kind of a weird venue because it's in Gillette.
Yeah.
It's you know, three quarters empty, even though there's thousands of people there because Gillette is so big. I remember there was
talk about their own stadium. I mean, I think it's always in talks.
I think
Marjorie, if they got a stadium in the city that you know sat maybe 25,000 20 had 20,000 seats, I think that place would be packed. I think the Revs actually set an attendance record a couple of weeks ago, and I could be misremembering this, so please someone correct me if I'm wrong. I thought I read that they had 26,000 people at their most recent home game. So if you, even if you had a stadium that was 20 or 25,000, you know, and it's closer and it's a true soccer stadium, you know, with all of the young people and the, and just the, like the number of like the diversity we have in terms of, you know, people who come here from soccer loving nations, I think it would do really well in the city and it would be great for the entire organization. Like you go to a game in Seattle, Seattle like sells out their stadium. Like people in Seattle and Portland are really, Kansas City are really, really into their MLS teams. Teams can have like fan success. You just have to tailor the experience to the soccer experience and not shove it into a football stadium.
Yeah.
I'm looking
if you're
this...
listening, Robert Kraft, build that stadium.
You should build it back better is what he should actually do. So I'm looking at the supporter shield. Marge, have you ever seen a photograph of the supporter shield?
No, no, I have not, Jim.
It's a supporter shield, essentially. they want it for whatever.
It's not related to jockstrap,
is it? Well, they have the best record. They have the best record
okay,
in the league.
Fine. Yeah. Now, before you go, how
what did you call it? The supporter
shield. Well, I wanted it related enough, to a jockstrap.
Well, that's really totally inappropriate.
Well, supporters. That's what I thought.
It's not called a supporter. It's not an athletic supporter.
No, that's what
it's
I was confused.
Shield.
I didn't know about this before.
Well, I think you probably did.
Okay.
Any reference to that part of the body, Marjorie never misses a trick. Let me just say, if I may, so before you leave us here, are you one of those glass half full for the Red Sox because no one expected them to ever go this far? Or half empty because they should have beaten the Astros and been in the World Series, and they blew it with three of the worst offensive games like in history.
No, I'm a glass half full person because if you had watched, I mean, I like bought into them because I really thought that they had like some juju and mojo.
I thought so too.
But that was it. Like, I didn't think that they were more talented than the Astros. I didn't think they were more talented than the Rays. I didn't think they were more talented, quite frankly, than the White Sox. Like, I was actually pretty like surprised that they made it that far. It was just disappointing because it's just disappointing because they clearly could do it at times and just couldn't like piece it all together. But that's how they were all season long. You'd see them play unbelievable baseball and then they would look like a minor league team.
Do you know
so it really shouldn't surprise them.
Is anybody at your station interested in the Houston Astros playing the Atlanta Braves in the World Series? I mean, it is what it is. They won their leagues. I mean, is anybody care about this if you're not from Houston or Atlanta? No.
Let me just tell you this. Here, today was like, when does the World Series start?
Exactly.
And then I got an email that said the World Series starts tonight. I was like, oh, the World Series starts tonight.
So enjoy Elfwood, Minnesota. Are you going to call us from there?
It's Eveleth, Minnesota.
Are you calling
and I will
us?
Be home.
Oh, you will.
I will be home from there. So I will full report about what it is like in Canada.
Congratulations.
That's pretty much where I'm going.
By the way, she broadcast the damn gold medal for the U.S. curling team.
She doesn't fool around, Trani Kuznarek.
Trani, it's great to see you.
Thank you, Trani.
Hi, guys.
Trani Kuznarek is a reporter and anchor for NBC Sports Boston. Thanks again to Trani. Coming up, how a massive change to the Afghan resettlement program will impact evacuees in the United States of America. We're going to talk to Ali Narani, our immigration expert, about that. Up next after the news, we're going to talk to Governor Baker at around 12:30. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, despite the U.S. declaring China's actions against the Uyghurs genocide, not a single one was granted refugee status in America this year. We'll hear from the National Immigration Reform's Ali Narani on that and whether immigration reform still has a chance in the Senate. Then it's Governor Charlie Baker. He'll join us. We'll talk about the state's rollout plans for vaccines for 5 to 11-year-olds, his thoughts on masks and casts, and we'll get his views on the chaos in D.C.
With Halloween just around the corner, Atlantic food writer Corby Kummer will tell us about the rise in horror-themed restaurants throughout the country and why so many are sticking to the horror themes year-round. Then CNN's John King will catch us up on the never-ending story. Democrats push for compromise with themselves and other headlines out of D.C. All that to come on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Thank you.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number 2 of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. Bunch of people asking when the governor's here. The governor will be joining us at about 12:30 today. So Afghan evacuees will get a little bit more of a support network and a massive change to the resettlement program just announced by the Biden administration. Now veterans and others with ties to Afghans can bring them to their own cities, help them resettle. Join us online to discuss this and a possible rekindling of immigration reform soon in the Senate is Ali Narani. Ali's the president and CEO of the National Immigration Forum. His forthcoming book is Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation of Immigrants. Hello there, Ali.
Hey, how are you guys?
Hey,
we're good.
Ali, great to talk to you. Well, let's start with something that maybe, possibly, just might be some good news for immigration reform. As the Washington Post reported today, Democrats are quietly scrambling to include immigration provision in this ever-shrinking social spending bill. So tell us what's going on.
Sure. So this all began, I would say, over the summer and into the fall when Senate Democrats and House Democrats started to craft proposals to take to the parliamentarian. Initially, as we've discussed before, the proposals sought to legalize and put on a path to citizenship the undocumented essential workforce. Senate parliamentarian said that those policy changes could not be included in the reconciliation plan. So they're now kind of backup plans, if you will. We're reaching kind of the window is closing here. So Senate Democrats are moving forward with a proposal to the parliamentarian that would grant a temporary work status to a number of undocumented immigrants. That number, according to reports, has been scored by the Congressional Budget Office and will be presented to the parliamentarian soon. On the House side, they seem to be still kind of focused on an effort to change the registry date. In essence, it's kind of changing the statute of limitations for someone who's been undocumented. So at this point, if I got here before 1972, almost 50 years ago, then and I'm undocumented now, I would be able to adjust status, no penalty. Democrats, there's another band of Democrats who are saying to move that date from 1972 to 2010, which would obviously cover a much larger population. But at the end of the day, like I said, the window is getting very, very tight here. And the pressure is really increasing on the White House and on Leader Schumer to ultimately perhaps overrule the Senate parliamentarian and move forward with one of these proposals, regardless of what the parliamentarian advises.
And by the way, from what I understand from the House progressives, I don't know anything about the Senate rules, the presiding officer is either the Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris, or Patrick Leahy is the senior member of the body. They believe that unilaterally that individual has the power to overrule the parliamentarian. So if they're right, once again, the Democrats have the power to do this if they play anything similar to how Mitch McConnell plays. This could happen, no?
This could happen. And yes, the vice president could issue a rule that says, okay, when it comes to these immigration provisions, the parliamentarian doesn't need to be paid attention to. But on the other hand, you still need, 50 votes of Senate Democrats to get that package across the finish line if it was to include those measures. So
wait, yes. Let me guess. Joe Manchin and Kirsten Sinema don't like it. Is that where we are?
They have both said privately and publicly that, they're agnostic in immigration. They're happy to see these things included. They have not raised concerns around the provisions themselves, but does that mean that they would stay in that position if it was overruling a parliamentarian? We don't know.
But
what does this mean for the Dreamers, Ali? And those people, of course, are people who came here as young children, infants, 2 years old, et cetera.
This is the million-dollar question. So there are approximately 800,000 individuals who are protected under DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. They remain in a program that is renewable every 2 years. There's a larger population of Dreamers that don't have access to that DACA program because of the cutoff date. But there continues to be a lawsuit in the South District Court of Texas that is threatening DACA as a program. So, if Democrats don't get immigration provisions into reconciliation, Dreamers' lives are still, incredibly unstable because of this lawsuit and really the temporary nature of DACA as a program.
For whatever it's worth, I know this is stating the obvious, but let me just say this could be a once in a whatever opportunity, even though you say the window is closing. The window is closing on Democratic control of Congress, too. And so this may be it. And it sounds like, once again, they don't need to convince any Republicans. They just need to convince their own members that providing protection for people who the Democrats regularly say they care about protecting is worth 50 senators supporting. So let's hope something happens. I'm sorry.
No, and remember when reconciliation first started and kind of all these conversations over the summer, it was Senator Bernie Sanders' proposal that included, I want to say, $2 or $3 billion, if not a little less, for border security. So if I was an advisor to Senate Democrats, I would say, you know what? Yes, include these provisions that protect Dreamers, but also include the provisions around border security and make a big freaking deal about it. Because absolutely, ultimately, the American public is actually much more worried about the status of our border than, the long term stability of the lives of Dreamers who, you know, not that they don't care about them, but they're saying, you know, we can fix that problem. Let's understand. Let's get our border in control. And I just think Democrats are they're talking to a progressive base when there's a much broader swath of voters who are, you know, want a constructive approach to these solutions, these problems.
By the way, which is exactly what this poll of independents showed this weekend that we're going to talk to John King about in the 1 o'clock hour. But now we're talking to Alan Rani from the National Immigration Forum.
So tell us about this White House proposal on resettling the Afghans that have come here, obviously fleeing their country in that disaster. What's this deal about them and veterans?
So this is, I think, a brilliant move by the White House. And I want to give our neighbors to the north in Canada a lot of credit here. So for years, Canada has had a program where an individual family could sponsor the resettlement of refugees to Canada. They still work through resettlement organizations, you know, through separate kind of programs. And we did a couple of events with some think tanks here in town, as well as officials from Canada a few years back, to just start to try to socialize this idea. The numbers in Canada who would resettle individually were not huge. But what happened is that people were telling their individual stories of, I'm a Canadian and I helped resettle this person. This is why it's important. Now, the Biden administration is announcing a similar program in that Afghan evacuees, they can, families or individuals, if they raise, I believe, just over $1,200 and commit to helping an evacuee resettle over a number of months, that individual Afghan or their family can then work with this group of five individuals and really kind of set roots here in the U.S. Of course, again, kind of through refugee resettlement organizations like Catholic Charities, you'd still see large numbers, but it really diffuses the responsibility and the opportunity to help Afghan families resettle into the United States. And I think really helps the public writ large understand why this is important to veterans who are raising this money and welcoming Afghans, as well as to everybody else.
Why is this seen as a radical proposal? When I'm reading about it this morning, I'm saying this makes total sense. Why haven't we been doing it in every comparable situation?
That's a really, really important question, Jim. And I think a lot of this was, we have always done refugee resettlement a certain way, right? We've always worked through organizations. We've always kind of run this formula. And, you know, when Trump kind of blew up the entire system, organizations were not able to kind of put their capacity back in place quick enough. So that kind of created a space and an opportunity for policymakers to really rethink, okay, how do we resettle refugees? I still think the majority will be resettled through organizations. But again, the story and the power of having that personal relationship between a veteran or any other American who raises the money and makes the commitment to help an Afghan family, I think really helps the public in a much larger scale understand the importance of this.
By the way, my understanding, my numbers may be off a little, but the roughly half of the evacuees are in the United States at some base. Half are at our bases around the world. What's happened? I mean, I'm assuming I'm close to right, at least. What's happening to those who are not at bases here in terms of permanent settlement?
So a lot of folks are in what are called, what's happening now is that there's continues to be an effort to evacuate a number of folks from Afghanistan, mainly, you know, women and girls. Get them to lily pad countries so that there's an initial set of processing. And then from a lily pad country, then they're moving on to a military base, let's say in Germany. And then in Germany at a military base, what is happening there is the next level of security vetting. vaccinations, and then really, in essence, kind of waiting for the pipeline to open up here in the States as people who, the roughly 50 or 60,000 people who are in military bases in the States, are able to move into communities. See. So there's kind of a pipeline that's going all the way from, you know, a military installation base here in the States to, you know, people who are still trying to evacuate from Afghanistan itself.
One last thing about the evacuees is a Wall Street Journal piece saying that the, by their count, close to half of the evacuees at these bases in the U.S. are kids. But what they don't say, they say we don't have the information on whether they're unaccompanied or with their families or guardians or whatever. What would the likelihood be? I understand border crossings, southern border crossings and unaccompanied minors. I'm assuming there are not many unaccompanied evacuee children from Afghanistan. Are there?
You know, we've heard kind of conflicting estimates there. Some of the initial reports and kind of news from our colleague organizations that the numbers of unaccompanied children were actually larger than, you know, anybody would anticipate.
Really?
Because, I mean, look, if you are a parent in Afghanistan and you have a, you know, a family of four and you can only get two people on a plane, you may very well make that decision. Okay, I'm going to send my kids ahead for their safety. And so that's. You know, I think Defense Department, HHS, and Department of Homeland Security really need to clarify who is here and what ultimately what services and support are they going to need, particularly in the case of unaccompanied children.
So, Ali Noorani, the United States government has said that the campaign against the Uyghurs in China is genocide, but apparently we've taken almost nobody in recent years from there. But part of it is our fault. Part of it is because China is making it really difficult for any of these people to get out. So give us the status of that.
Yeah, so a lot over the course of the Trump administration, there was increasing amount of pressure to really identify what was happening to the Uyghurs as, you know, genocide. And finally, I think in the last day of the Trump administration, Secretary of State Pompeo made that statement. Now, like you said, the problem is that, you know, people are unable to get out. I think that there needs to be an increasing amount of political pressure from the Biden administration, corporate pressure on the Chinese government to change their ways at best, if not at least, you know, create ways for people to get out of the country, create ways for Uyghurs to get out of the country and to apply for asylum. But the flip side of this, Marjorie, is that our asylum system itself remains hopelessly backlogged. And I think that the Biden administration really needs to prioritize, you know, ramping up the capacity of our asylum system. So it's not taking 3-4 years to process an asylum claim for people who are so clearly fleeing just awful circumstances.
You know, I can't be the only one who doesn't really understand much about what is happening with the Uyghurs in China. So for those of us who don't know, why is this occurring? Why is this genocide happening?
So this, in essence, is a Muslim minority in the Xinjiang province of China. And over the recent years, we've seen more and more reports of, in essence, re-education or concentration camps of massive scale that are being set up by the Chinese government to, you know, force these individuals to change their beliefs, change their culture. And there are reports of sterilization, torture, and just really, I mean, things that you would not think would happen any longer in the world, much less in China, which is such an economic powerhouse. And as a result, folks are being tortured, like I said, and they are looking to the United States to seek asylum. And our system and our politics are unable to meet the challenge.
You know, by the way, I don't know if you know him, but Nick Burns, who I think is a terrific person, who is a local, who's worked for both in the ambassadorial ranks for both Republican and Democratic presidents, is Biden's nominee to be ambassador to China. And in his hearings, I know he took a really tough line on China in terms of the Uyghurs, and I find him to be a person of great principle. Do you know him at all or know of him?
No, but I did read about his hearing, and I, you know, that was very promising. And the other part about this, I should say, is that there's deep bipartisan support for pressuring the Chinese government on this and providing ways for the Uyghurs to apply for asylum and seek protection in the U.S. And I just think that, you know, from a moral perspective, this is the right thing to do. And from a political perspective, this is the right thing to do.
We're talking, to Ali Narayani, President and CEO of the National Immigration Forum. So people may recall that during the Trump administration, there were all sorts of arrests of people who came to the United States illegally, but basically had been minding their business and following the law since they got here.
And voted for Trump in many cases, by the way.
Well, if they were here illegally, were they voting?
No, no, I'm not saying they should be deported, spouses. But these were not like radicals.
That, yeah, they were not. They were not. But in any case, they were being deported. So I apparently the Department of Homeland Security has changed the rules about who gets deported and who doesn't. So update us.
So I want to take a step back here because I think the reporting is missing a really important part of this story. So let's go back to the Obama administration. Under the Obama administration, we saw record numbers of deportations, record numbers of arrests across the country. In fact, I have the data in front of me now. In fiscal year 2011, there were approximately 280,000 arrests of unauthorized immigrants in the interior. That number dropped to 110,000 in 2016. And Trump, only by really deprioritizing any sort of law enforcement resource, he was able to get the number of arrests up to about 143,000 in 2019. So my point here is that's a lot of number. My point is that arrests of undocumented immigrants have been going down since the Obama administration high water marks. Wow. And the Trump administration, just by saying, you know what, if you are undocumented, full stop, we are going to come and get you, which was actually terrible for public safety. Because what happens is that, you know, ultimately, if you are an ICE officer and you're spending time and money pursuing a landscaper, you're not spending your time and money going after an actual public safety threat. So we think that the new enforcement priorities by the Biden administration are just smart law enforcement, because you know, we should not be spending tax dollars on people who are not public safety threats. We should be spending our tax dollars in a much smarter way.
So what are they focusing on? Those who are public safety threats, those who have recently crossed the border illegally, I assume, but they're saying that being undocumented in and of itself should not alone be a basis for deportation. Is that a fair summary of where it stands?
That's a perfect summary. You hit a really important point there, Jim, in that recent border crossers remain a priority for detention and removal, and that's why you continue to see the detention numbers themselves up higher than many advocates would like to see.
You know, when we spoke to you, I don't know if it was several weeks ago or several weeks before, I've lost a sense of time. That was when the crisis was happening under the bridge with the thousands of Haitians, and they were being deported without asylum claims allowing to be heard, at least in most cases. Is it Title 42 or Section 42, or what is that thing?
That's Title 42.
Title 42, originally imposed by the Trump administration, basically to say, from what I understand, during a pandemic, you can break due process rules that had existed before. Is the Biden administration still doing the same thing, or have they backed off?
So the Biden administration continues to implement Title 42 and, in essence, continues to expel individuals who cross the border even to ask for asylum. So what it means in practice is that their asylum case is never heard and they are never actually kind of processed formally through the detention or deportation system. So what that means in many cases is that it leads to a high rate of recidivism, because the cartels are saying to a desperate migrant, pay us $5,000 and we will give you we'll organize three attempts to cross the border. So that's why, you see these high border apprehension numbers. It's because of these rates of recidivism. And I've said this before, it's like we have outsourced our immigration system to organized crime. They are the ones who are determining who can cross the border, the U.S.-Mexico border. And they are quite frankly creating a diversion for Border Patrol so that a couple miles down the road, they can continue to smuggle massive amounts of drugs into the U.S.
So I assume the experts other than you know as much as you do. Why are we still operating under these rules? Is it just I mean, theoretically, it's pandemic related, but I assume it's for efficiency purposes and shows a total lack of humanity, at least from where I sit. No?
So I think the Biden administration is, you know, they continue to rely on Title 42 as an enforcement mechanism. And, you know, they haven't been able to stand up the resources or the infrastructure necessary to process claims at the southern border. And I, you know, they're in a political corner that is just not a really tough place on this. And, but then they're also under pressure now by the courts to reinstitute the Remain in Mexico program or the migrant protection protocols, which, you know, kind of takes Title 42 and ramps it up so that even individuals whose asylum cases are moving forward, they have to remain in Mexico while those cases are being heard. So, you know, I think the Biden administration, they can do some legal things in terms of setting up kind of the process to turn these programs around, like the protection protocols, the right way. But, you know, through, quite frankly, the stroke of a pen, the president can lift Title 42 and, you know, quite frankly, instead of relying on HHS to enforce the border, actually, you know, rely on DHS to do its job.
You know, I've asked you this question many times, but why not ask it one more time, Ellie Narani?
I like that spirit, Marjorie.
Well, you know, it just seems the more I learn and the more I talk to you and the more I read, people's efforts to get over the border in massive numbers is not going to go down significantly. We're not going to be able to fix the corruption problems in Central America or South America or countries that are economically struggling. So it just seems as though this is just going to be a constant. And even if we do put more border security there, it's kind of like a needle in a haystack kind of thing. Where am I wrong? Straighten me out.
So I think, you know, ultimately what we have tried to do for decades now, and not just the United States, but around the world, is kind of enforce our way out of a migration challenge. And the facts, the reality is you cannot enforce your way out of a migration challenge. You've got to figure out a way that migration is regulated and managed, not just at the U.S.-Mexico border, but in our case, really across the Western Hemisphere. And that means on the part of the U.S. actually creating legal immigration pathways. Right now, the only reason people are applying for asylum is because that is practically the only way that they can legally enter the country.
Yep.
If we had, you know, if we had a better a program for the tourism industry, for agriculture, for construction, et cetera, people would be thrilled to apply for those visas. They don't want to put their lives in the hands of a cartel. Nobody does, but they've got no other option.
Ellie, as always, we learn a lot from you. Thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
Thank you. Ellie Narani is president and CEO of the National Immigration Forum. His forthcoming book is Crossing Borders, The Reconciliation of a Nation and Immigrants. Ellie, thanks again for being here. Coming up, Governor Charlie Baker will be here to discuss the state's plan for rolling out vaccines to younger kids and much more. Governor Charlie Baker is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Any second, we'll be joined by the governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker, joining us for his monthly visit. Are you calmed down since the first hour about the state of affairs in Washington. Do you see how Nancy Pelosi's quotes today already trying to lower expectations? Let's embrace what we're getting, you know, sort of. And she didn't say the second half, rather than bemoaning what we have not. So I know she thinks she's going to have some unhappy campers there.
Yeah, I think she's going to have some very unhappy campers because, as I said a million times, these are things we really need. I mean, infrastructure and infrastructure for families are these things we really need. So we're hoping the governor's going to reach us very soon. We're going to talk about the fact that the state expects to get, assuming the FDA approves these things, and we expect that they will approve these vaccines, that we're going to get the first doses of the COVID vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds
next week
on November 5th, which is pretty exciting. Mary Lou Sutters, who runs the Department of Human Services in the state, said it's going to happen. It's going to be interesting to see what happens because there have been polls, national polls, that saying a lot of parents, some polls, two-thirds of parents are not keen about giving their vaccination to little kids. But I know an awful lot of parents who just can't wait.
Well, actually, in the two-thirds number, the thing I've seen that's most upsetting is only a third, which I guess is a variation of what you said, have said they would definitely get their kid vaccinated as soon as the Pfizer 5 to 11-year-old third dose, we were told yesterday, it's a third of a dose, it was approved for kids. I would hope they get them early. The governor has said he's got a plan. He's waiting for this. Again, we're waiting for him. We'll talk to him in a second. And it's expected, as you said, that those doses are available next week. Did I read that we have 550,000 5 to 11-year-olds in Massachusetts?
515,000.
Is the governor on the phone? Sorry. Joining us now is the governor of the Commonwealth. That would be Charlie Baker. Governor, good to talk to you.
Hi, guys. How are you?
We're
hey,
good.
Governor Baker, thanks. Thank you. Thank you very much for taking the time. We appreciate it. We were just talking while we were waiting for you about the fact that assuming everything goes well with the FDA and approving these vaccinations for kids, that we're expecting to get COVID vaccines for 5 to 11-year-olds by November 5th, which is pretty exciting for the 515 eligible children around the state. How are you going to go about doing this?
Well, most of it, I think, will be done by the hundreds of sites that are already available in Massachusetts, with the addition of a whole bunch of pediatricians' offices and community health centers and healthcare providers. And in some parts of Massachusetts, the regional collaboratives that we set up to do boosters will also be doing the pediatric shots as well. And then there'll be some stuff that will be done based on, you know, where we think we have deserts or opportunities to do vaccines in places where people are looking for them, in addition to the hundreds of sites that will be available around the Commonwealth to begin with.
Are you nervous about the winter?
I think you're going to see a lot of it happen in the places where kids normally get a lot of their flu shots.
Well, you know,
pharmacies, hospitals, doctor's offices, that kind of stuff.
You know, Governor, we talked a little while ago about how this weird loophole in the who has to get vaccinated rules says that staff and pediatricians' offices do not have to get vaccinated. I mean, I hope most of them would be, but there's a certain irony if you're going into your pediatrician's office to get a vaccine from an unvaccinated
fire 'em.
Staff person there. What do you think about that?
Well, that depends to some extent on the organization you work for. I think many of them are part of larger healthcare systems that do have vaccine mandates in place. Some people are doing mandates and tests if you don't get vaccinated. So it varies, I think, a fair amount. But I think I think that's certainly something people can check with their pediatrician's office on before they go in. And if they don't like what they hear, they can go to a different location.
You know, as a former healthcare guy and a father, and whatever, when you hear about people in healthcare facilities not getting vaccinated, and again, if there's special circumstances, obviously we all are empathetic. Does it not drive you absolutely nuts?
You know, I obviously have gotten a lot of incoming from a lot of places and a lot of people on these issues, in part because we have a requirement for the folks that work in the executive branch. And we've also worked with our colleagues in the long-term care and assisted living communities to put mandates for vaccines in for the folks who work there because of the vulnerability of the people they serve.
Yeah.
And I, you know, honestly, I guess what I would say, Jim, is that I just wish I could figure out a way to make it work for them. I mean, a lot of the people I talk to are very earnest and they're good people, and many of them worked all the way through the pandemic and you know, never took a day off, and we owe them a lot. And so it's hard for me to be, you know, angry about it or something. It just doesn't make any sense to me to be angry about it, given all that these people in many cases have done for other people in Massachusetts through this whole process. I wish I could just figure out what it is that makes the sale, because I know that they're safe. I know they're effective, and I know they make our Commonwealth not just a safer place, but most importantly, a more vibrant place and a place that's more normal than it was, you know, 2 months ago or 3 months ago or 4 months ago. I mean, when I say to people, look, you know, for the most part, we are open in Massachusetts. For the most part, people can go to the places they want to go to and do the things they used to do before the pandemic. And while we still have COVID cases, it's nothing like it was before. And for the most part, we've done a really good job of keeping our seniors protected. And I wish I knew the magic combination here to get them over the line. I just don't. In some cases I succeed, but in a bunch of them I don't.
Well, Governor, it seems like, it, despite the complaining from the union for the state police about not wanting to get vaccinated, the union head, it seems 85%, I think, of the state troopers are vaccinated, so we can feel secure if we get caught speeding on the Mass Pike.
I think they're over 90 at this point.
Yeah.
Okay. And the state workforce overall is north of 95. And I, you know, like, look, there's no question the vast majority of the people in all of these jurisdictions and departments got vaccinated. The vast majority. You know, when you're over 85%, when you're talking 9 out of 10 or 9.5 out of 10, which is pretty much the case across most of state government, the vast majority of everybody's colleagues got vaccinated. It's a really good thing. I mean, if you think about the law enforcement one, you know, there were 5 times as many law enforcement officers who died of COVID over the course of the past 2 years as died from a gunshot. Now, they are both horrible tragedies, okay? But 5 times as many law enforcement officers died of COVID. I don't think I'm being unreasonable when I expect them, for themselves and their families and for the people they come in contact with every single day, to get a safe and effective vaccine.
Couldn't agree more. We're talking to Charlie Baker. Governor, you said a minute ago, you were talking about workers who did their jobs through the pandemic. We talked to you last month about your contretemps with the legislature over these federal $5 billion from the feds.
You want to define contretemps?
Well, whatever. You can define it.
What a great word.
Thank you. Over this ART money, it appears they're coming close to meeting you on affordable housing, doing something on unemployment. They proposed, I think it was yesterday, up to a $2,000 bonus for low-income essential workers who had to work through the pandemic. Do you support that?
I just want to see the details, Jim, but I think I would say to both you and Marjorie that when we originally proposed what we proposed, I got asked about the essential worker piece, and I said I actually thought that was the kind of thing that would make sense to go through some sort of a public hearing process and for the legislature to make a recommendation on that. And while I hesitate so I see the fine print on most things to comment, I do think conceptually, this is something that's the right thing to do, and we'll do the best we can to implement it.
We're talking to Governor Charlie Baker. Governor, there's two issues in the mayor's race in Boston which involve, well, there are probably more than that, but these are the ones we're going to focus on. As you know,
they involve him.
regional kind of approach, statewide look at things. And one of them is the situation down on Massachusetts Avenue and Melanie Cass Boulevard. I know you said you support Sheriff Tompkins' plan to bring into his facility, former ICE facility, not the jail with the locked doors and all that, but a former ICE facility, people who have outstanding warrants, and give them treatment for drugs or for mental health issues for 90 days. But the candidates both, Michelle Wu and Anissa Sabi George, last night in the last debate were going on and on about how we need a regional approach because Boston seems to be taking care of everybody. So I'm wondering if you talk to other mayors or what is happening to get this regional approach achieved.
Well, we have, we've been talking obviously to the mayor's people and with the AG and with the courts and with the DA's office and the public health folks at the city for about a month now, I guess. And what they've wanted us to help them with is alternative services. And some of those alternative services will be in Boston, but a lot of them will be in other parts of Massachusetts. So I do think the support and the help we're giving them, primarily around different kinds of treatment beds or other kinds of supported services, are very much, some are in Boston, but a lot of them are outside Boston. And they're consistent with places and spaces where we had capacity to begin with. In many cases, it's about new capacity, or in some cases, it's literally about holding capacity that we do have and making it available for mass and cash.
Who would you vote for if you lived in Boston?
But I don't live in Boston, Jim. And I mean, I'm not usually one who ever gets involved in municipal races, particularly. I've gotten involved in some races where there are candidates or incumbents who've been supporters of the lieutenant governor and me in the past. But generally speaking, I tend to stay out of ones where I don't have sort of a prior history. And in this case, I don't have a prior history.
Okay, I didn't think you'd answer that, but you will answer this, I think. A major point of disagreement.
Who are you going to vote for, Jim?
Unfortunately, we don't have an elected mayor in Cambridge. When I was on the council, if they had listened to me, we would, and I would be voting for somebody for that thing. But thank you for the question, Governor. Another contretemps, actually, a major disagreement between the candidates is over rent control, rent stabilization is what it's called by Michelle Wu, who supports it. Obviously, Councillor Sabi George does not. The point was made repeatedly by questioners and by Sabi George that obviously the city can't do it by itself. It has to do it by home rule petition. The legislature would have to pass it. You would sign it. Should there be something coming out of the city under a Mayor Wu that sought to reimpose some variety of rent control or rent stabilization? Is there any circumstance in which you could see yourself signing it?
Probably not. But, you know, I'm going to leave the door open a little bit because it may be there's something that could be done to deal with this. I mean, I do think that we filed $1 billion for housing in communities that were hard hit by COVID on both home ownership and rental housing, senior housing, supported housing, affordable housing. There's no question that we think housing is probably the single biggest cost of living problem we have in Massachusetts. And we did a lot of work with Mayor Walsh and his team to build and to invest in all kinds of affordable projects all over the city. My three big problems with rent control are, as it was originally, you know, envisioned, is number one, it's unfair. I mean, I lived for a bunch of years in Boston paying market rent when I was a young person next to two apartments that had older folks in them that made more than me, who paid about half what I paid in rent because their apartments were rent control and mine wasn't. And as we all know, that was in many ways one of the biggest issues people had with rent control generally, which is that it basically was it did not treat everybody the same, and your income had nothing to do with whether or not you had a rent control apartment. The second issue is it really does affect development of new housing. And Lord knows, here in Massachusetts and in the city of Boston, we need a lot of new housing. And the third issue is it doesn't give any kind of predictability at all to tenants or to landlords unless you happen to be in one of those units. Now, if somebody has some other way of thinking about how to make housing more affordable without destroying our ability to build more, which we desperately need, you know, I'm happy to hear what that might be. My answer to that was, part of my answer to that was my $300 million in the ARPA proposal to spend on home ownership for first-time home buyers, because I think that one of the major problems we have in Boston, especially in the communities of color in Boston, very few people control their own destiny because very few people own the home that they live in. And the spread between white home ownership in Massachusetts and black home ownership in Massachusetts is about the biggest in the country. And we should try and do something about that.
But by the way, you know, one last thing. I don't want to debate rent control with you today. Obviously, rent control is not like written on a stone tablet. It's whatever the drafters choose to do. If they want to means test it, they can means test it. That was a big issue. If they want to exempt 2 and 3 family homes, like Asabi George is worried about, they can do that. So it's in the eye of the beholder, of the drafter. It's not some, you know, concretized kind of proposal is what I'm trying to say. But I know you know that. So in any case, by the way, before we leave that.
Which is why I said probably not.
Okay. By the way, when you lived in Boston, when you were much younger, if Wu and Asabi George should run against each other, who would you vote for then, Governor?
Larry DeCara,
a great and legendary city councilor.
Just one quick thing
about this ARPA money. I know that you were pushing to get this ARPA money out quicker. The State House has just announced a House leaders up there have proposed spending some of that money, but it's a lot of it still held up. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, how long do we think this is going to be held up for? It does seem...
I don't know. I mean, what I will say is...
It's been months.
I'm actually kind of excited that the Speaker and the Senate President both said they want to get a comprehensive proposal to our desk by, I think, the 17th of November, which is, 3 weeks from now, which is... we filed our proposal in May, and I do think there's urgency to this. I mean, I get the fact that that they wanted to have a delivery process. That was why we only filed to spend about half of the money originally. But I really do hope they come to an agreement and they send us a pretty comprehensive proposal by the time they break, because I don't think we should wait another 2 or 3 or 4 months to get started on some of this stuff, because some of it will take a while to do.
Yeah.
And some of the people need now. I mean, the workforce training stuff, the skill building stuff, the apprenticeship programs, the rapid reemployments, those are things where we can start matching people who are looking for work with employers who are looking for people. And I want that's important, especially since we still have places and spaces in Massachusetts that have really significant unemployment issues.
We're talking with Governor Charlie Baker. Governor, some environmental people that devote themselves to the climate change issue have expressed some skepticism about the administration's seriousness. The Globe reported last month that the plan for the state is way behind in its phase one for addressing climate change, the plan for converting 100,000 homes a year to heating and cooling with electricity instead of fossil fuels. Just 461 homes got converted last year. There was another disturbing story about how the state asked for a draft of planning a gas-free future, and the Department of Public Utilities, I think very oddly, asked the first draft to be written by the gas companies that the draft would be getting rid of, more or less. So what's your rejoinder to those critics?
I'd say two things. First is you got to replace whatever fossil generating fuel you don't want as part of your future with something else, right? And we currently are in the process of implementing, and we were first, the largest collection of offshore deep water wind projects in the United States. And we're talking hundreds of thousands of homes that will be powered by these projects, maybe even millions if you count the third procurement that we've got. In addition to that, we've got one of the largest projects involving Canadian hydropower, which is 24/7, 365 power, unlike wind, which, as we all know, you can only use when the turbines are turning. It's working its way down from Canada, which is also a major substitution for our existing power generation capability here in Massachusetts. And we also have some of the most effective programs in the, we have the, you know, one of the things we did a pro, we did a, we're the only state in the country that's actually developed a net zero by 2050 proposal and lays out a roadmap on how you'd actually get from here to there. And it was part of what was incorporated into the legislation that I signed back in January to get us to that net zero by 2050 proposal. And, you know, and finally, I would just say that among other things, we are the only state in the country that's actually put together a coalition to talk about clean heat in the future and to figure out how we get from here to there. It's one thing to say you want to get there. It's another thing to actually do the boring, nerdy work associated with figuring out the how. We've also been leaning really hard on our colleagues at the federal level about the grid. You know, no one wants to talk about the grid, but the simple truth is, if you want to electrify all the things that everybody wants to electrify, you need to do two things. You need to make the grid a lot less fossil fuel driven than it is now. And that's what all those proposals I just talked about, especially with respect to wind, are all about. And the second thing you need to do is you need to fortify it and make it capable of doing a lot more than it does now. And that's got to be done on a regional basis. And we, you know, I think we're the first region in the country to start talking seriously to the feds about how to do that. So I think a lot of the stuff we focus on isn't all that exciting, but it's the stuff you actually have to do if you want to get from here to there.
But one last thing about this, it seems odd to me, and I'm not an expert on fossil fuels, but it seems odd to me that the Department of Public Utilities would want the gas companies to write the first draft of an effort to get rid of the gas companies. You know what I mean? It just is like a fox guarding the chicken coop kind of thing.
I think it would be that way if you asked them to write the last draft. I don't think there's anything wrong with asking him to write the first draft.
Okay, Governor, thank you.
We're talking to Governor
Which one ultimately becomes operative, Marjorie? Is it the first one or the last one?
That's a good point.
The best part about asking them to write the first one is you get a sense from them about how far they're willing to go. And then you take their draft and you build on it and you push back. I mean, that's not that unusual, especially when you're talking about something that really matters to millions of homeowners here in the Commonwealth.
I guess it's the revolving door thing that you think that maybe too many people from industry back and forth. You know what I mean?
Well, that one, that's okay. That's a different issue. And I, even there, I guess what I would say is it depends on the nature of the work somebody was doing and which point in time they were in which job. I mean, the simplest way I could put it is I have a tremendous amount of faith and trust in Secretary Theo Harides, who oversees energy and environmental affairs. And I'll put her bona fides up against anybody's.
We're talking to Governor Charlie Baker. Governor, you're going to be very disappointed to hear I've decided this month not to ask you the monthly question about why are you still a Republican, even though I would argue it's the perfect month to do it since you urge the rather limited chair of the Republican State Committee to step down, I would argue, for very good reason. So for this month's purposes, we'll accept that you're staying a Republican. If you were a Republican in Washington in this hugely important, I think everybody would agree, so-called reconciliation bill, the so-called social infrastructure, climate change, Democrats only as of the moment measure were to come before you, would you support it?
So, Jim, by now, I think you should have figured out that I tend not to comment on legislation I don't know anything about.
I don't believe that. I'm sorry.
Are you kidding me?
Respect.
You don't know much. No one knows. I mean, people in Washington don't know what's in that bill.
Governor. We do know, unfortunately, that free community college is probably jettisoned. We know that the strongest climate change provisions are gone. There's going to be something on affordable housing. There's going to be something on home care. There's going to be something on universal pre-K. A lot, though not enough, on climate change, etc. So, again, it's a thing in process. I would agree with that. But the direction it's going, and it would have a tax increase. Well, let's turn the question around. If Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren said to you, you run Massachusetts, are these things important enough for you that we should support this and urge your Republican colleagues to support it? I assume you'd answer that, wouldn't you?
So my first comment, this one won't make you happy. My first comment would be pass the infrastructure bill. There's tremendous agreement on that. Everybody knows what's in it. It got a ton of Republican votes in the Senate. We desperately need it. It would be a huge boon to the country and to the Commonwealth and to the economy. Pass the infrastructure bill. And then if you want to go on and debate how you want to handle some of these other issues, terrific. But I do not understand. You know, I'm in the business of yes, okay? And I do not understand why a piece of legislation that everybody supports, that has bipartisan support, and that was finished for all intents and purposes so that everybody understood pretty much what was in it 3 months ago, still hasn't gone anywhere. And it's because it's being held up over a debate on this other thing, which honestly, Jim, you can say what you think is in and out of it. I pay a fair amount of attention to the news media on this stuff. And the message I get from it is no one's even agreed yet on how long it's supposed to last. And there's a big debate about, well, maybe we should just leave everything in it and shorten the length of time on it. Or maybe we have it go longer and we take things out. That thing is very amorphous at this point in time. The infrastructure bill is not. I don't know why they don't just pass it.
That's the physical infrastructure bill, for those who don't understand, the bipartisan one that was $1 trillion. One last crack at this, though. Does it not trouble you, regardless of what the end point looks like? I think you know the basic outlines, at least most, I think you know the basic outlines. Does it not trouble you that it's likely that not one single Republican is going to support a bill that includes provisions on these issues, most of which, as far as I know, are issues that you care deeply about? Does that not bother you as a Republican, Governor?
I don't know what it is, Jim.
Okay.
I can't.
I give up. Okay.
What bothers me the most.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what bothers me the most. The lack of sort of civility and sense of common purpose in Washington, that bothers me a lot.
Yeah.
And I absolutely believe it. And I think it bothers a lot of Americans. And I think it's a big part of the reason why so many people are so negative about people in public life. We've tried pretty hard here to be collaborators, and I think for the most part, we have a pretty good track record. And if you just look at the way people generally feel about COVID and what's good and what works, I think the overwhelming majority of the people in Massachusetts, you know, have a fairly similar sense about what we should be doing and why. And I do feel that that's because we have tried to speak to the extent that we can on a collaborative basis on this stuff, whereas, you know, the messages coming out of Washington around this have been almost impossible to create kind of a coherence about. And I think that's a problem.
Let's talk about something that people can get excited about. You know, you can win a lot of money, apparently, guessing the color of the Gatorade that's dumped on the winning coach in the Super Bowl game. You know what I'm saying? So, Governor Baker, I know you are in favor of sports betting. You wrote the day of the Patriots opener, great to see the Patriots back. We filed a bill in 2019, again this year, to legalize sports betting in Massachusetts. Let's get this done. We're losing out money. But apparently, up at the State House, I would think it's Senate President Karen Spilka is not very interested, it seems, in sports betting. So where are we? 30 states have already legalized it.
Well, that's my big worry, is just the number of states that are already pretty far, to run your analogy, there are a whole bunch of states that are pretty far around the bases, down the field. Take your pick.
Beautiful.
With respect to this so far, and I certainly think that I know people who live in Massachusetts who drive to New Hampshire just to do it.
Yeah.
And I don't know why we wouldn't just incorporate the very basic framework that's been adopted by most of these places, so the people in Massachusetts can play and to generate the revenue that's associated with it and make sure that some of it gets put to good use to help people who are dealing with gambling issues and other other issues like that to use. But to me, this is sort of becoming like the debates and the discussions we've had about a number of other quote unquote new things over the years, whether it be medical marijuana or marijuana period or other stuff. And it's pretty clear that this is going to be where the country goes and where states play. And I don't know why we wouldn't just sign up like everybody else.
So if we had sports betting in Massachusetts and there was an opportunity to bet for or against whether Baker was running for a third term, how would you now, this may move Spilka. I'm trying to help you out, Governor. Would this where would you place your money and how much?
Hello? I put it on black and red.
Didn't you tell us during the summer, Governor Baker, I'm serious, I can't remember precisely, you're going to talk to your wife, you're going to talk to your kids, you're going to talk to the family, your friends, whatever, and that come post-Labor Day, you're going to tell the voters in Massachusetts if they'll have an opportunity to vote for or not for you come November of next year? I'm serious. What's the timetable?
I do remember that.
So what happened?
And we are post-Labor Day.
And
we'll make a decision soon.
Have you made a decision?
It's a very complicated issue, Jim, for all kinds of reasons.
Well,
you'll be the first to know, Jim.
No, but in a moment of seriousness, it sounds like you've made a decision and you're not yet ready to announce it. Is that a fair analysis?
No, it's not.
Okay.
It's not.
Why is it complicated?
Are you serious? Really?
No, I'm totally serious. I'm just asking. I don't mean I'm not asking in a quarrelsome way. I'm saying what are the considerations that are going into this?
There are lots of considerations to go into a decision like this. Some are professional and some are personal. But anybody, let's put it this way. Anybody who makes a decision about something like this without thinking really hard about it, isn't doing themselves, their families, or the communities they want to serve any favors. Because you're signing up for something that is hugely important, and if you decide to do it, and it comes with an enormous amount of opportunity, and at the same time, tremendous challenges, many of which you don't get to know about in advance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 20 days after we took office, it snowed for a month.
Remember?
That was followed by the first drought we've had in a really long time, which was followed by bomb tornadoes and hurricanes at the beginning of the summer season down on the Cape, which was followed by the Merrimack Valley gas explosions, which was followed by a global pandemic. So, you know, don't be surprised when you get surprised in a job like this.
Governor, we really appreciate your time, as always. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Governor Baker.
Hey, so when are you guys going back in the studio?
Well,
we're actually in the studio right now.
In the studio today. We welcome you back in the studio. We're all vaxxed up. Jim has gotten multiple boosters.
Not multiple. I got one. In all seriousness, not that we should waste time on air saying this, if you wanted to be in the studio, which we much prefer, and I think you do, we can actually move to a larger space in the building where we'd be able to be distanced a little bit. So our staffs will talk, but we'd love to see you in person, Governor.
Yeah.
We're here at least a few days a week.
Well, I'd like to do that, too.
Great.
By the way,
you guys going to hand out candy on Halloween?
Yeah.
I have to do it this year. Have you noticed how many Halloween decorations? It's like this Halloween palooza all over the state.
People are in a big way.
They are. Are you handing out candy?
Yes.
I saw your old boss, Governor Weld, when he was handing out, doing apple dunking in the foyer of his Fairweather house.
And John Kerry had to rush home, don't you remember?
John Kerry had to race home because the maid had been giving out candy, and Kerry had to rush home. Remember that?
After they moved the fire hydrant.
That was a great story. That was a great story.
Okay. Yeah. Governor, happy Halloween. We'll talk to you in November.
All right, guys.
Be well.
Take care.
Thank you very much. That, of course, was Governor Charlie Baker, who joins us every month. We much appreciate it, and we thank him for being with us. Coming up, you know, by the way, speaking of running for governor, people may not know that Jim Browdy, whose head got a little big when he became famous statewide for question three, goes too far.
Yeah.
He threw his hat into the ring for governor. Remember that, Jim?
For a week, I was running for the... I was. That is true. Why would you mock that?
Because
you
were talking about the decision you need to make for... And some people think
number
that they
columnists
just be...
endorsed my candidacy, if you remember correctly. They did, actually. Do you remember that?
Jim was endorsed, but somehow he pulled out after a week. We won't go into that sad tale at this particular moment. Anyway, coming up, food writer Corby Kummer is here with the latest news at the intersection of food and policy. Corby Kummer's next on Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us now for about as long as his introduction is Corby Kummer. Corby is the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at The Atlantic, senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. And I want to apologize in advance. This is going to be a short segment. The governor was here and John King is coming, but we love you anyway, Corby. Nice to see you.
I know my place.
Okay, Corby Kummer. So tell us about public health and how it seemed to be a cure for an ailing industry. This is from the Aspen Institute, where I think you...
He wrote it. He co-wrote the piece.
And you work as well. So tell us what you said.
I had a little something to do with it. So this is the idea that even in the face of Delta variants, worker threats to their safety... that public health, by essentially enforcing mask mandates, encouraging businesses to make it easier, offer very good and constructive dialogues to get your mask on if you are endangering workers, this can be a real help to worker safety. And it's another version of our safety first guidelines for COVID safety for restaurant and food service workers. There's a new online training specifically for health departments around the country. So the head of the CDC Foundation and I wrote this piece saying, hey, all you health officials, sign on. It's free. It's great. It's got great ventilation tips, too. So public health can really help by, I would like eventually them to offer money for ventilation systems and little portable air purifying units. But in the meantime, they can be really friendly about enforcing mask guidance and strongly suggesting that you wear masks in public places.
I should know the answer to this, but when you just said offering some, it'd be great if they offered some money for ventilation rehabs and that sort of thing. We may have discussed this with you. Is there any discussion at all in Congress about including in this so-called reconciliation package or in subsequent legislation some relief to at least independent restaurants? It's going to be a pretty tough winter, even though hopefully the pandemic is on the wane rather than the rise.
You just said two of the magic words, the Independent Restaurant Association, which formed after the pandemic. A lot of not just mom and pops, but nationally prominent starred restaurants, award-winning restaurants, are right now lobbying Congress to include an increase of the restaurant relief that was in the last relief package in the current reconciliation bill. It's not been specified. They have very specific plans, and we hope that it'll pass.
I was down in New York for a few days last week, and you have to show your vaccination card every time you go into a restaurant. And boy, it was a great
That's
feeling.
Great.
It was terrific. It was no muss, no fuss. Do you have your card? Yes, I do. Here it is. And you could eat inside reasonably far apart, knowing that everybody there was vaccinated. I don't know why we didn't have a chance to ask Governor Baker about this, but I would love to see that here. It's such a relief.
Next time you have Governor Baker on, next time you have the mayor on, strongly suggests that vaccination be a requirement for restaurant entry and that the state and the city make this very known that they are behind it. So that doesn't put managers in the position of acting like they invented this when they have nasty customers.
And by the way, I'm still surprised. I mean, we've had this discussion about when Pagu in Cambridge led the charge. The charge never happened. There were a handful of restaurants in Greater Boston that joined in on this got to be vax thing, but it unfortunately went virtually nowhere.
One last thing about this. A lot of the hesitancy, because most of us in Massachusetts, the vast majority of us in Massachusetts, are vaccinated, it seems like an odd business decision. I get it. They're worried about the few people that are going to make a stink and carry on and so forth. But more people, I think, would be going to restaurants if they thought they were going to be around other people that are vaccinated. So I don't get it from a business perspective, unless it's just the fear of the bad apples yelling at them.
It's so easy to bash anti-vaxxers. And Chef Russell Sherman in Harlem has been one of my main, just my main man in being a spokesperson for Safety First. He showed me a crumpled up a photo of an anonymous letter he got based on a radio appearance of his that went national. And it was from a guy in Las Vegas saying, "I've been vaccinated and I believe in it, but I do not believe in being told what to do. And do you think restaurant customers want to come and have this thrust into their face when they come through the door looking for some escape? I spend $75,000 a year on restaurants. I don't want the government telling me what to do." And this was a letter that wasn't saying I'm anti-vax. It wasn't threatening Chef Russell Sherman. It was just saying, essentially, I'm a libertarian and I don't want to be told what to do. It's very useful to get these points of view that are not entirely dumb and that are pro-restaurant, just anti-government.
Well, yeah, so they say. I mean, I have to say, we don't know who the Las Vegas writer was. You hear that a lot. I'm not anti-vax. I'm pro-freedom.
But the government says you got to be 21 to get into the restaurant to have a drink.
Well, and also the other end of the spectrum, I am somebody who probably spends more money on restaurants than any activity in my life. And I don't go to indoor restaurants unless there's a vaccination mandate. But obviously the calculation has been made by the restaurateurs, Marjorie, that I'm in the minority, even though I'm vaccinated, as compared to the average customer. You know, staying in restaurants for a minute, Corby, we read a story about how wage theft, which we've discussed with you a lot in the years we've been together, is even worse now than it has been in the past. Why even worse? What's the motivation for employers to be illegally withholding wages from workers?
So wage theft is a really good phrase that One Fair Wage, which is leading this battle, has come up with, and we're always going to use it now. It's more like wage neglect. What is this? 40-something states still allow the tipped minimum wage, which means as low as $2.13 an hour, allowing employees who are wait staff to have the liberty to take home all their tips based on that. Now, the catch is that the restaurant manager, it's on the manager to look to see, was the average hourly earning of those tip minimum wage staff members of mine, did it equal or better the state's minimum wage? And if it didn't, the managers, have to make up for it by paying them enough money to make them whole. There's less and less. There was never much enforcement of this. There's less enforcement than ever now. There's evidence that there's more of this failure to make up for any of these losses than there was before the pandemic. It amounts to theft. It might not be deliberate theft. It might be just plain neglect. But it points out the flaws of the tip minimum wage system, which ironically, many staff members prefer. They want the jackpot of more tips.
So, Corby Kummer, we were mentioning before how all around the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, you see really elaborate Halloween designs. It's really incredible what people have done. And one of the theories is that people have been home so much, they just decorate their houses elaborately. But in any case, this New York Times story talks about kind of these horror, scary restaurants, including this Terror Tacos in St. Louis, where they have the red paint covering one wall and long drips, like, you know, someone was stabbed to death in the restaurant. But these are apparently popular. What's the story?
So one of the things I thought going into the New York Times story about, you know, carnage asada instead of carne asada, which is very funny, is that it was something about the pandemic and having mock horror instead of the true horror of your family members and your colleagues dying because they're unprotected. But one of the main facts of this story is that horror movies have always been a popular theme in fast food restaurants. And the longevity of this, and the number of speakers in this piece who say it's family fun, it unites the family, they want to be scared, they like doing this together. Now, of course, the week before Halloween, everybody's talking about it and they're great bloody themes, but it's like wholesome family fun. And it starts off with these two brothers who run restaurants in, where is it?
St. Louis.
And they both are, you know, horror movie fans, and they're completely tattooed and long-haired, and they have this very scary blood drip decor, and you know, they're very wholesome family guys.
Yeah, yeah. I'm there. You know, speaking of that,
did
we got to go.
Pictures.
I did see their photo. Marjorie's holding it up for me, which really doesn't help the people at home.
Wholesome
but,
family guys is not the word that comes to mind.
Governor Baker asked us
they are.
At the end of our discussion if we were giving out candy for Halloween. And we both said yes, because you have to say yes whether you're doing it or not, or you seem like a you-know-what. So what is a food guy, what do you hand out for Halloween? I never thought of it before the governor asked us.
Okay, so you know the way a gift is always supposed, you should give gifts that you yourself would be happy
of
to
course.
Receive. So I know everybody likes mini Reese's peanut butter cups. I hate peanut butter and chocolate. Therefore, I will get something like Butterfingers or Butter Crunch or Nestle Crunch, the Rice Krispies, because that's what I always wanted as a kid. So I think you have to go and get what your favorite vice is, if it's Milk Duds, if it's Sugar Babies, and give that.
By the way, in exactly that train of thought, Marjorie knows what I give out every year is little corned beef sandwiches of Swiss on rye with mustard. You give what you're most into.
That's right.
You're a very generous guy, Jim.
Kids in the neighborhood love it.
Yeah.
Corby, I'm sorry we were short today. It's great to see you, though. See you next week.
Great to see you.
Corby, thank you very much. That was Corby Kummer, of course. He's our food expert, executive director of the Food and Society Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Up next, we are talking to CNN's John King about the latest out of Washington, D.C. Oh, my God. The scramble to finalize a signature spending deal that encompasses much of President Biden's domestic agenda, excuse me, which is shrinking by the moment. John King next, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. I'm hoping Marjorie can make it through this segment because joining us online to go over the latest political headlines, including what's happening on that Democrats-only multi-trillion dollar bill, is CNN's John King. John, of course, is their chief national correspondent and anchor of Inside Politics. Just be careful. Marjorie's very fragile today about this issue, John King.
I am here to help, Marjorie.
Thank you very, very much. Well, it's just, you know, so many people that could really need, and their lives would be so changed if they could get help with their child care costs, if they could get help when they're elderly with dental care, and you know, and which is, it's just depressing, I think, that we can't do this. But I'll shut up now and ask you, what's left of the social spending bill, and where are we in getting some agreement on it?
By all accounts, they are very, very close, but they're having some issues just getting across the finish line. Number one is, what's the final price tag? And once you know the final price tag, you can decide how much you have to divvy up between the different programs. Speaker Pelosi was talking to House Democrats today, and she made crystal clear that they're close. And she told the progressives, like you, I'm not happy that it's gotten this small, but we can still get a lot in here. And so her message is, you know, failure is not an option, and we're going to get something big. It may not be as big as we wanted a month or 2 months ago, but it will be big. My biggest question now is that they need to calm Bernie Sanders down a little bit. And by that, I mean just, you know, Sanders ran twice for president, whether you agree or disagree with him. He ran twice for president and got millions of votes campaigning on the government should be able to negotiate the price of prescription drugs to drive down drug costs, and that Medicare should be expanded to include things like better vision and, you know, better hearing, better dental, things like that. And at the moment, his two signature proposals are not in the final bill, and he's not happy about it. He said this morning that no real Democratic spending plan could omit both of those proposals. So you can't, you know, we always talk about you can't pass it without Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Well, you can't pass it without Bernie Sanders. Everybody's vote matters in the Senate. So they still have some work to get there. I will tell you, though, Jim and Marjorie, that all of the Democratic conversations in the last 72 hours, especially the last 24 hours, the tone is different. They're all saying we're going to get there. And everybody on the phone or in the text says there's going to be something I'm, you know, not happy with. They use stronger language. And but we're going to get there. So that seems to be the momentum. But until they're there, I would have a dose. But I do think by the end of today or tomorrow, you're going to see at least a framework of that deal, and then they'll see if they can put it in writing.
Well, I know you're a commentator and a reporter, John, and not an opinion writer, but there's something so depressing to me is about the fact that people want these things. They really poll well. As you point out, Bernie Sanders did get lots and lots of votes. And that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, these two people, are holding up what millions of Americans really want. There's something really horrible about that in terms of what it means to have a democracy. The minority.
You're absolutely – listen, I get the frustration that you hear from liberals. You're right. It's not my job to agree or disagree. But I get the frustration, especially from progressives who ran in places like New York or Massachusetts or California, who said we're going to go big and bold. Joe Manchin's answer is Donald Trump got 60% plus in my state, and I can't sell that. You know, I can't sell that back home. My voters don't want as big a role of government in their lives. That's what he says. You know, Sinema says the same thing, that, you know, she just won with – just barely won last time by a point or two. And I know a lot of people are saying the demographics of Arizona are changing and she should be safer, but she says, this is what I believe. And there's the whole subset group, and we talked about this last week a little bit. Is it because she gets pharma? Is it because Joe Manchin has both state and personal, you know, family business ties to energy? There's a lot of that going around in the Democratic family. I would look at it this way, though, Marjorie, for a slightly contrarian view. That if the Democrats had not won those two seats in Georgia after Joe Biden was elected president, they would be getting none of this. And so there was a 1.6 or 1.9 trillion COVID package. The bipartisan infrastructure plan is about $2 trillion, and they're going to do somewhere in the ballpark of $1.7 trillion in this new, they call it reconciliation or Build Back Better, pick your name for it. There are a lot of Democratic agenda items in those three pieces of legislation. They all get to the finish line. Is it, you know, the $7 billion or $6 billion that some progressives want at the beginning? No. But it will be the most sweeping domestic legislation passed in the last 25 years. It will be that, even at the price tag it is now.
We're talking to John King. John, you obviously have some spectacular expertise when it comes to interpreting polls. Independents who love Joe Biden last November don't love him so much today. And the pollsters over the weekend are saying it's in part not because they don't support these items that he's trying to sell in this package at margin you were talking about, but because I think their point is We're not hearing enough about other things we care about front and center, namely ending this COVID scourge, and the border apparently continues to be a major issue for
inflation and independence. Some of those other polls, too, is a big deal.
So how much is this hurting Biden? And the conventional wisdom that at least I had subscribed to was if he gets this bill passed, then he begins to recover. But these substantive concerns would suggest that he may not recover so fast. Where are you on your interpretation of all this?
Well, one thing I would say is, you know, you have to go state by state or race by race to look at this. If you look at national polls, there's one finding or reading you can get, one take you can get if you read a national poll, and then you talk to a politician from somewhere else in the country that might be more red or more blue, and they'll tell you, not where I live. But there's no question. I think there's a couple pieces of this. Number one, if you watch, you don't have to go far. The coverage about what's happening at the border. You remember the camp out of those Haitian refugees not that long ago. And so you put all that under the umbrella as Joe Biden ran saying, Donald Trump doesn't understand how government works. I do. I will fix things. I will be competent. We will get things done. When we see challenges, we will deal with them quickly, maturely, responsibly, and we will get them done. And so when you see people camping under a bridge in Texas, you say, I thought you were the competence guy. Mm-hmm. When COVID goes down but then comes back up again because of the Delta variant and because a lot of Republican governors are not helping on the public health front in encouraging vaccinations and encouraging people to wear masks, Joe Biden's president. So even though some of these problems might be exacerbated by Republican policies out in the states, he's the president, and he pays a price for that. I think you're right. Everybody I talk to, I just had Democratic pollster Anna Greenberg on my show. Most of the think it will, it will at least stop the slide and perhaps begin a modest rebound to pass legislation to show, I said I could get things done, and here I am. I'm getting things done. Marjorie is dead right that most of the proposals in the Democratic bill are very popular, not just with Democrats, but across the board. But I do think, Jim, after you have had a slump, it's going to take a while to convince people, that you've figured it out and you're on the way back. Part of that is the economic numbers have to get better. Part of that is inflation has to die down some. That's hurting the president, and it's not something he has a ton of control over. And the COVID situation has to get better. It is getting better at the moment, and so we're having a conversation in, October of this year. It's October of next year that matters when it comes to the midterms, unless you're the candidate for governor in Virginia.
Terry
McAuliffe, who was the governor before, was a big Clinton guy. He's running again, and it's very close with the Republican again, Glenn Youngkin, who and I think people were surprised in Virginia this is so close. What's going on?
And Jersey is getting closer and closer, too, with the incumbent
Murphy, the governor down there. But Virginia first.
Well, I think it's all tied. The dynamic in both places is tied to what Jim was just talking about and what you were talking about. Democrats are, Democrats are a little down in the dumps. Number one, Democrats are exhausted. 2018 midterms, fighting Trump for 4 years, 2020 election. Democrats are like, can I have a break from politics? And Obama was in Virginia over the weekend saying, no, we can't afford for you to take a break. Sorry. But Democrats are discouraged, right? I thought Joe Biden was going to pass this big sweeping agenda. Why are we fighting? Why is the family fighting publicly every day? Independents are saying, where is it? Republicans are saying, here's my first chance to kick Joe Biden. And so Republicans are energized, and Democrats have a little bit of a morale problem. Virginia is a blue state. It is very close right now. Terry McAuliffe has no excuses, if you will, in the sense that, he's got a well-financed campaign. All the big hitters in the Democratic Party have come in. The state is trending more blue by the day. But you have a Republican candidate who so far has managed to thread the needle of trying to keep the support of the Trump element, which is huge in western and southwestern Virginia, without being a Trump Republican and not inviting Trump in. He's been clever, some would call it cynical, in saying as governor he would outlaw teaching of critical race theory. Guess what? Critical race theory is not taught in Virginia. So he's going to outlaw something that's not happening in his state. But this is an issue you're going to hear a lot. Look, the Republican has run a smart campaign. He simply has. So McAuliffe should be able to win a close contest given the state of voter registration, the state of the demographics of the state. If he doesn't, Democrats are already a little nervous right now about next year. If McAuliffe loses a week from today, they're going to panic.
You're not a commentator, so you don't have to comment on this, but Terry McAuliffe, who we met up in New Hampshire
during primary.
To me, he's got a used car salesman problem.
Oh, geez, Marshall.
And he's also cooking the – he's not being truthful apparently about the COVID numbers in the state. So you wonder if some of this is just – I don't know. He's a tough sell for my money.
Well, I'm not going to argue with what you just said, but let's put it this
John
way.
John King, do you think he is a used car salesman, Margaret?
You know, I'm suspicious.
Terry a long time. I covered the Clintons back in the 90s.
Yep.
Terry was a very important fundraiser for them. Then he went on to be the party chairman.
Sure.
Listen, you don't even need to use disparaging terms.
Okay, sorry.
He's familiar. He's been around a long time.
Yeah.
No, he's been. Voters are often looking. In the case of Joe Biden versus Donald Trump, voters wanted the known, identified, even, I don't mean old by age, but the guy we've been around,
yeah.
A comfortable blanket. Joe Biden was a comfortable blanket after all the turmoil of Trump. It worked for him. In most elections, people are looking for something new and looking for something
yeah.
different. Youngkin is an attractive Republican candidate. I'm not endorsing his policies. That's not what I'm saying. But in terms of he's telegenic, he says, I'm a new generation. I'm a different Republican. I'm not Trump. Terry McAuliffe is, I was your governor before. I'm very close to Joe Biden. I know everybody in Washington. That's not a great message.
Yeah.
At a
yeah.
time when Washington is not performing very well still.
Exactly.
And so he's running essentially like Joe Biden. I know how government works. Give me my old job back and things will be good. He also defeated two African-American progressives in the primary, and he needs African-Americans to come out and vote for him. So there's a whole number of complications to that race that often new and interesting. You've had this play out right up there in Massachusetts politics. You're having a mayor's race right now. Often new and interesting gets more excitement. Just does. That's how politics works.
John, if I asked you this exact same question last week, my apologies, and pretend like I didn't, and then we can do it again. If McAuliffe loses on Tuesday and Murphy, who I think still has, a 6-point lead or something, let's assume even he loses his race. Two Democrats who were favored by a lot, I think, go down. Does that have potential to scare enough moderate Democrats in the House that the whatever deal is allegedly going to be struck today, tomorrow, or Friday on this larger package in the Senate could disappear in the House?
That's a great question. Would it scare them? Yes. Would they back away from an agreement that they signed? I don't know the answer to that. That would be something we'd have to watch. Look, if Virginia is a blue state, it's a narrowly blue state, so it's still competitive for Republicans. Yeah. But if Phil Murphy also lost in New Jersey, then you're going to have a full panic in the Democratic Party. Now, will what people do in that panic, will they do the right things or will they just, flail? I think that would be the next conversation. But there's no question it would be a huge body blow to the party, Biden, if they were to lose both of those races. And there are people out there listening who are saying, what does Joe Biden have to do with what's happening up there? I get it to a degree, but that's just the way it works. In a midterm election, a president's approval rating is the North Star. It is the single most determinative factor of what happens in a midterm election campaign. So if those two go down, you're going to have a lot of Democrats trying to figure out, where do I run? Where do I hide?
Yeah.
And that would cause chaos.
So, John King, this January 6th commission is looking at connections between some members of Congress, the White House, obviously, and the people that showed up to riot that day. You know, I think we're not surprised by who they are. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Boebert from Colorado, Mo Brooks, Alabama, Louie Gohmert from Texas, and a few others. What does this mean for these people?
Well, I think it means they're looking every for pieces of evidence and clues. Who met with whom? Who knew who was coming? Who financed the operation? Did anybody get any inside information either deliberately or did it, let's say some member of Congress gave some people a White House tour. Let's not immediately jump to judgment that they knew those were nefarious people who were going to do horrible things the next day. But we deserve to know if they did. We deserve to know if they did, and then we deserve if they gave them that tour, and then we deserve to know what were the conversations, the communications, the emails, the texts before and after. Did you have any clue? My impression so far is that this committee is actually doing a really good job asking questions to build the documentary. Can we see your schedule, Congresswoman? Our Caitlin Collins reported today on my program that a handful of former Trump staffers are communicating with the committee, are sharing some information. We focused on the high-profile names who are saying no, but there are some people who are engaged in conversations and have had interviews with the committee. So I reserve judgment. I don't want to criticize, Congresswoman Boebert or Taylor Greene or Mo Brooks, accuse them of anything that we don't have evidence for, but I hope that they would cooperate with the committee, because if they had nothing to hide, what's the harm? Right? Even if you gave somebody who turned that actor a tour, if you can prove I had no idea, it's a constituent, and I just did my job, okay. Okay, you know, fine. Then let's get all that into the record. And so my impression so far is this committee's doing a really good job of saying, what are the key questions? Who financed this? Who came? Who knew about it? What was Trump doing the week before, 2 days before, that day? I'm impressed so far with how they're out there being reporters, if you will, or fact finders to get the information. And I think we, you know, I would hope that anybody listening, whatever your partisan views, would be good. That was a horrific day in our democracy. Let's gather every crumb of information and then put it together and see where it takes us.
But John, before you go, I was going to say goodbye, but in light of your last comment, you would hope everybody in the country would say it's good. We need the information. Every time something like analogous to this happens, I say to myself, let me close my eyes and try to imagine the Trump voter who still supports Donald Trump, who would be moved if, for example, this committee demonstrated that, in fact, some of the leaders of the insurrection had met with White House staffers to plan this. You talk to a lot of real people in your work, which I really admire about you. Can you imagine the Trump supporter who'd be so upset they'd say, I just can't support him anymore? I can't.
I have faith in information. And in fact, Jim, I get your point. So many people are so dug in on this that, you know, that they believe it was just, you know, it was a big peaceful rally and a few people might have gotten out of hand. That's not what happened. We all know that. There were police officers beating the vice president of the United States at the time, a Republican, an honorable public servant in many ways. I know there are people who disagree with Mike Pence, a lot of things. But, you know, they wanted to hang him. They were chasing him. The Speaker of the House, they were saying, we're going to get you, Nancy. It was not that day. So I would hope so. From a family of seven, let me put it this way in the context of the holidays. From a family of seven who's been through a lot of feisty Thanksgiving dinners and Christmas dinners, I've actually seen minds changed once or twice inside the King family based on information. I hope that could happen in the country.
Great. So do you know how many days till spring training or you don't?
I'm not there yet. I'm not ready to count those days yet. But okay. You know what? If roll the tape back to March when we all said that team would be horrible. They gave us a good ride. They gave us a good ride.
John King. Campers. John, it's good to talk to you. Be well. Talk to you next week.
Thank you, John.
Take care.
John King joins us every week. It's very uplifting to talk to John King, isn't it?
He is. Well, he believes in democracy, yeah. And he's probably a little more hopeful than you are.
He's CNN's chief national correspondent as well, and anchor of Inside Politics, which you can see every day on CNN. It's at noontime, isn't it? Politics.
Right in the smack dab in the middle of our show.
We watch it every day. No, we shouldn't be.
We actually do.
Anyway, thank you very much to John King. Coming up, where have all the blurry, natural lens flared photos gone? Or the terrible photos, which you can now fix to make less terrible. I'm going to open the lines and ask you about the death of the horrible photo and what else we lost to the internet. That's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Brown. I think this segment should be called Progress is Not Always Good. I think that's going to fit.
Uh-huh.
When's the last time I took a bad picture, a blurry, overexposed image? You kept it anyway. Well, with smartphones and Photoshop and everything we see can be all altered, nitpicked into perfection, or just erased. So if we're being, let's call it cynical, it warps our perception of each other. We aren't allowed to look bad anymore. Smartphones have also given us, of course, on the other hand, the gift of inexpensive and immediate memory sharing. You also don't have to buy film, which was very expensive for your young people who don't remember. Rubbing the lines, I ask you about photos. Does it matter how we share them so long as we stay connected with our family and friends? Or, let me put it better, does the image altering of today reflect something that should trouble us? And I want to add something else to that, Marjorie. This gets back to progress is not always good. Hard copies of yesterday. Here's what made me think about this. Yesterday, Marjorie announced on the air that she was in New York last week to meet her brand new granddaughter, Ellie. And she comes over to show me a video compilation her younger daughter made.
It was weird.
Marjorie, she's like, her shoulder is on top of my shoulder. She's contorted so I can see. Because I got to look at a little tiny phone to see the damn images of this kid. 20 years ago, you would have handed me a bunch of hard copy photos.
Or actually,
of your granddaughter.
I probably would not have done that because usually you just share those things in your home, kind of with your family.
Maybe so.
You didn't subject all your colleagues to pictures, and they really don't give a damn about it. I think it's nice. You have a grand newborn baby, but I mean, you're not that interested. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't agree with that. I think a lot of people. One of our coworkers, Aiden, walked right in and said, "Let me see the photos."
Well, he was trying to be nice.
No, he was not. He was interested in the kid. But that's not even the
he
point.
He says he was
the
not.
The point is, we are missing something, I believe. Most progress and most phone stuff I love, I have to say. The convenience, everything's in your hand, everything's in your pocket. The disappearance of the hard photo, and please don't call and tell me you can print them out. I know you can. Is a great loss. You know what's also a great thing when you're with family? You have a box of photos at Thanksgiving, which I know is one of your favorite holidays. You throw them out on the damn table. You spread them out. You look at the ones. You hand one. That's missing. And I don't think that the convenience and the affordability of doing this thing on your smartphone is good enough. So we want to know if you miss photos as much as I do. I'm not clear if Marjorie does or not. The number's 877-301-8970. And the other point that's made about this perfection thing, and it's true, there's no such thing as an imperfect photo anymore because you just erase the damn thing, which gives you a weird perspective of...
You can fix it. You can change the light.
You shouldn't fix it.
Well, that's what people do, though. You can change the light or you can change... Well, like with the selfie. I mean, whoever knew that we'd be so into taking pictures of ourselves? But you can have the you can do the selfie till you really look good in the selfie, right?
You know who the king of the selfie is in this state? We just talked to him about a half hour ago. Who? Charlie Baker
is the king of the
selfie. Oh, he takes a selfie. He's really good with constituents on that issue, by the way.
Yeah.
A lot of Baker selfies. 877-301-8970. I hope I'm explaining this right, because we don't have a hell of a lot of time. It's just it seems we had lost something by virtue of the fact that there's not a physical photo you can look at yourself, you can hand to your coworker, you can look at with your kids, your spouse, whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, you're looking on your phone at a compilation of photos. And
or an individual photo. It's just not the same.
You can make those photos unreal because you can fix them.
Yes.
And you know, in the olden days, Jim, when you go to CVS or wherever to drop off your film, and if you had 12 pictures, 16 pictures on the roll, probably 4 of them would be good.
Of course.
You know, the rest of them would be terrible. And you were stuck with the bad ones. And, you know, you have some member of your family. My father used to say this, the camera never lies. Even when you have a horrible picture of yourself, the camera never lies. But now the camera does lie because you can fix and recreate the lens. Everybody looks good.
You know what's interesting on the Smug Mug, which you talk about ad nauseum on the show? Your picture, I think, was slightly altered. You look great before. You look super great after. They altered mine to make me look worse, I would argue.
Wait a minute.
What's that?
Slightly altered.
Yours.
It was?
Wasn't? Oops.
I don't know.
877.
I hope not. I thought I just looked particularly dashing.
No, actually, I take that back. No, you looked fabulous. You did. No, you did. I just said you looked great. And you looked even better.
Jim just said my photo, which people say was really great, is Photoshop.
No, I did not say
yes,
that.
You did.
I said a variation on that. Let's move on because I really regret what I said. Valerie, you're in Holden. You're on Boston Public Radio with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browdy. Hi.
So excited. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
We love that.
Thanks,
Valerie.
So I recently upgraded my phone, and when we were switching it, there was a moment where she wasn't sure that they had gotten all my photos. And I have 3 kids, and there was honestly, though, a moment that I was, relieved. I was like, then they're gone. Then I'm not supposed to do something with them because I just feel like they sit on my phone and I'm supposed to do something with them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't. I never have the time to make some video or some, you know, book and share it with everyone. It's more like, oh, the school needs your kindergarten photo. Let me see if it's still on my phone. And I go back and I look for it and I have to find it.
That's a great point.
And then it reminds me, oh my God, I haven't developed these in 10 years. What am I going to do? And just, for a second, I felt like, oh, wow, they're gone.
Well, can I tell you something? Occasionally, they are gone. When I've gotten new phones, almost without exception, I've lost, I don't know, 10% of the photos. And when you think hard and you're upset about it and you realize it was an non-duplicatable, whatever it is, picture of your kids when they were 6 and 8 or something. It is really painful.
But they're in the cloud, Jim.
And you make, Valerie, that was a great call, a great first call. Thank you for doing it. Well, sometimes they are. Sometimes we don't back them up as well as we should. Valerie, thanks for the call. And you don't look at them. Like Valerie was saying a minute ago, if you have them in a box or you put them I've never done this, but my mother used to do it. You know, put them in whatever those little books are called or that sort of thing. Scrapbooks, thank you. Having to look, it's just, this is, again, one piece of progress I think we could do without.
Photos for my.
Your mic's not on, I don't think.
It's not?
I don't know. Now you are. Go ahead.
Am I on?
Yeah.
Paul emailed and said, photos remind him of a line he's heard from people who use online dating, which is, if we meet and you don't look like your photos, you'll be buying me drinks until you do.
I think that's horrible. Well, of course, it could be a man or a woman, so it's not quite as horrible as I thought.
Kathy in Providence, thank you for calling.
Hey, Kathy.
Hi, you guys. It's my first call, but I've met you at Silent Spring Auctions.
Oh, great. Yes.
Were you the woman taking the pictures at Silent Spring?
No.
Oh.
I'm not the person who was photographing. I am on the leadership council, so that's what brought me there.
Silent Spring is a great organization that looks at the link between chemicals and breast cancer, and they've got it's a great organization to check out, especially now during Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
Well, Kathy, good to talk to you again. What's up?
I'm a photographer, and I use both film and digital, and I had this conversation with my photo lab yesterday, and one of the things that is going to be a serious concern is that in the future, you're not going to have any system that can read what you're saving today.
Mm. What do you mean?
You've got to scan. Say again?
What does that mean?
Well, if you have a scan that you're saving, there's going to be software that's different, and it may not be able to open the scan.
It may not open the photos that you took 10 years before, is what Kathy is saying.
So all these hundreds of photos that we have on our phones right now, Kathy, may be disappearing.
That's a real good possibility. It's not what I wanted to take, so I use negatives. But that's an issue also because trying to get the film, I'm using 120 film, which for somebody who's not a photographer is 2.25 by 3.25. And it's only made, well, there are only two films that have survived. One is made by Fuji, and they discontinued it. And the other is made by Kodak. And Kodak got the, well, it's actually not made by Kodak anymore. The settlement for Kodak bankruptcy was the line of film that apparently the it was a bunch of people who were trying to make money on. Well, anyway, it was the settlement, and they don't know what they're doing, really, and we don't know how long it'll last. That they continue to make both the paper and the film. So it's.
Hey, Kathy, before you go away, you may not know this because you're a professional, not a commenter on these issues. If I went to a CVS or a Walgreens and tried to buy film, could I buy it?
I don't know. I think you can buy it, but they keep your negatives.
Okay.
Or so I've been told. I don't go there, so I'm not sure. And I know that 35 millimeter has problems because there's something about the machinery that enables the actual canister to be made. And I've heard from the person who there's one processor in Rhode Island now that does film. And she told me that there's no 35 millimeter coming out because nobody knows, or the processing is broken. And one of the things that stopped my lab from photographing or from processing film was that the machinery is so out of date, they've had to pirate everything they can to fill in for things that break, and they finally ran out of resources. And in some cases,
this is depressing.
Film,
okay.
Hey, Kathy.
Well,
most importantly,
we
love the organization you help lead, Silent Spring. Check it out online. It is absolutely wonderful. Thanks for your call. By the way, our colleagues are weighing in, meaning our coworkers. Mackenzie says, depends on the CVS or Walgreens. Many still have disposable cameras. Actually, I've seen those. Some have 35 millimeter, but it's rare. Walmart also sometimes carries 35 millimeter. Well, I won't be gone there. And Rebecca says, the bad photo is not dead to my aunt, who takes candid photos of everyone. I love relatives like this, shoving their faces at Thanksgiving and uploads and tags everyone on Facebook, which makes her mother angry every year. I love that internal family sort of thing happening. We're talking about how at least one of us, I still don't know where Marjorie is in this, misses photos of old, the hard copies of photos you can touch, you can look at, you can the tactile thing to me is a real big. Don't you like touching a photo, holding it in your hand?
Well, you made me feel better about photos in boxes because I always felt bad that I never got around to putting the photos in the boxes in the scrapbook. So I've just got piles of photos in boxes. So you make me feel better.
Well, you know what
that.
A lot of people do, by the way, to throw away that crap mm-hmm. in the spirit of what's her name? Of giving joy to your what's her name?
Oh, I forget the woman whatever. That did the dispose of your
Throw out all your crap, whatever her name is, in a minute. Is a lot of people take photographs with their phone of the photographs, toss the hard copies, do the reverse of what I'm suggesting, so it's all in their phone. You know, it's just it gives me the creeps.
Nancy from Weymouth, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. Love the show.
Thanks.
First time caller.
Marie Kondo, by the way, is who I was talking
Marie
about.
Kondo,
go ahead, sparking
much.
Joy. Go ahead, Nancy. Hi.
Hi. So recently I've been printing the pictures off my phone and in putting them in people's birthday cards.
Good for you.
Doing photo albums for like the holidays. And I tell you, out of all the various gifts people get, they get the most excited over the photographs.
Really?
They are thrilled to receive it. They're like, oh my gosh, I remember this event.
So you're talking about a physical photograph.
Yeah, printing a photo on your phone.
Yeah, I'll just print it at CVS and put it in their birthday card along with their, here's your birthday gift, here's your birthday card. And the most important thing, the thing that brings the smile to their face, is opening up the card and seeing an actual physical photograph of a wonderful memory.
You know why? Because they don't know what a photograph is. They're saying, what is this? Did you just invent this? Nancy, thank you for the call.
From Dennis, he says his favorite Christmas gift was an e-frame that runs hundreds of my photos on rotation for everyone to see.
Yeah.
So it's like a screen.
I've gotten those in the past. You ever got that for a Christmas gift kind of thing?
Yeah. Did you use it?
What?
Did you
use? I never put it to use. Never put the use.
Okay. And some people alter their profile pictures all the time. Who told me that?
Not some people. Almost everybody. I don't, but almost everybody. Well, you know why? Because you feel you're sort of lying to people. When you have a photograph when you're 40, when you're 80, you sort of feel like you're being a little disingenuous with those who are consuming whatever it is you're selling on social media. Hey, Faith from North Andover, we have a minute and it's yours. Welcome to the show.
Hello, guys. So good to talk with you.
You too.
I can't believe you're even talking about this because I'm listening to you in my car as I'm driving home from CVS after picking up my printed pictures.
Love it.
Wow.
I'm now standing in my kitchen putting the pictures of my beautiful grandchildren that live in Oregon in a frame. I can put it on the windowsill in front of my sink. A picture of my son and his new bride that just got married last month.
Oh, beautiful.
I know. I'm so excited about it. I don't think I've printed out a picture in probably 2 years. And I was so excited to go there today and get the pictures. And I'm looking at my beautiful grandchildren.
So what made you do this after 2 years? The
Karma.
New grandkid?
Well, my son that lives in Oregon, who finally sent me a decent picture of his children. after we've asked him 700 times the past year.
Well, Discord there.
And it was on my phone, and I'm like, I'm not going to enjoy it on my phone.
Good for you.
Their little faces.
Yeah.
Faith, perfect call to end this. And congratulations on the photos and the grandkid, and thanks for the call. I love that. That's what we should all do.
Well, it's kind of making you even more isolated, looking at pictures by yourself on your phone as opposed to having them on display somewhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay, we are done for today.
Point,
thank you very much, Jim.
You're very welcome.
Thank you very much for listening to us. We have a podcast. You can keep up with us 24/7. By way of that, you can get our podcast, Boston Public Radio, wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow, we're going to be joined by Boston mayoral candidates Michelle Wu and Anissa Sabi George. The mayor's race is, what, less than a week away?
Eight days. 7 days. Today's Tuesday.
Yeah,
a
week from today.
Yep.
We're going to talk to them both tomorrow. We'd like to thank our team, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, and Rebecca Tauber. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. What's on TV, Jim?
What is on? Oh, I know it's on TV. Tony Maws, Craigie on Main.
Oh, great.
Well, I don't know, great. I mean, we'll find out tonight. It's one of my favorite restaurants. It's closed down. He's going to explain what's happening. It was just announced the other day. You missed it. Is it permanent? I don't really know what's going on. He is pretty legendary in this town, and James Beard winner. We'll talk to him, and we're going to talk to the head of the Dimmock Center about beds there and whether or not they can help out with Mass and Cass, and going to talk to a man with him who is recovering from addiction, is going to talk from a first-hand perspective what the experience of MedicineCast is and why some people in those circumstances are not as willing to accept offers of shelter and that sort of thing. So it should be a pretty interesting show.
Craig, on Manus, where you had to get there early to get the cheeseburgers, you only made a certain number of cheeseburgers a day.
Well, let me tell you, that was the least of it. The food was spectacular. He was an incredible host. It's a great restaurant. And I hope it's not gone for good. He'll tell us tonight. But I think he's also going to speak to what ails the whole industry and our whole society, frankly, around
it. That's a big subject, Jim. I'll be tuning in for that.
Well, I hope you will. I'm Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. Thanks again for tuning in today. Hope you can tune in tomorrow. And meanwhile, stay out of the rain and have a great day.